Hey there everyone, and welcome to episode number one of the Doctor Who Show, the audio fanzine where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and if you're joining us from the Comic Book Show podcast or the Who Wars podcast, welcome back. If this is your first outing with us, let me try and briefly cover the kind of show we are and what you're going to hear. I guess, as an audio fanzine, the Doctor Who Show is made up of parts, and these parts, like articles in a fanzine, come from different people covering different topics and different aspects of Doctor Who. So my hope is that every month you'll be looking forward to who I talk to at the start of every show and what people and places the author and 5 Minute Fiction podcaster Ian Martin covers in his Doctor Who A to Z segment. We've got the Doctor Who magazine letters page being discussed by Jim Cameron of the Crinoid podcast and his sparring partner Bob Fleming from Proctor Who. We talk great Doctor Who merchandise in a segment called Who Teaks Roadshow. This time around we talk to Mark from the 42 to Doomsday podcast about a very specific piece from his private collection. And I hope you also really like the comprehensive wrap we do of Titans Doctor Who comic range. They do so many Doctor Who comics now. And we've got former Who Roars reviewer Lex on the case. We've got sci-fi blogger Kevin Jordan joining her. And also blogger and Star Wars podcaster Mark Suter, who you might have heard before on the Idiots Array podcast or maybe the Tarkin's Top Shelf podcast, if you like to dip your toe into that galaxy far, far away, that is. And I guess as some of you are former Who Wars listeners, that might be more than a few of you. So, yes, overall, this is a very collaborative effort, giving contributors a chance to step outside of their other blogs and podcasts to do something a bit different every month. And I hope you enjoy hearing them outside of their normal abodes, if you normally listen to them elsewhere. I think that's a lot of fun. And I do want to thank them, too. I do want to thank all of our contributors for their great pieces right here at the top of the show. Big shout-outs to our podcasting chums out there, and to kick off the show, I'm going to dial Andy. He's formerly the Rev on the Diddly Dum podcast, formerly a Who Wars contributor. He was the producer of the Doctor Who review show, which we ran on this very channel last year, and he's the mastermind behind the Top Geek podcast. And we're going to have a belated chat about the Doctor Who Christmas episode, The Husbands of River Song, and I hope to touch briefly on what we thought of Series 9 too. I'm sure there'll be a few detours as well, so let's get this going. Yeah. Well, g'day, Andy. How's things?
Hey, Rob. Not too bad. I do enjoy the physics, if that's the word, of these conversations, knowing that we're at opposite ends of the world, and you know, it's a sort of chilly Sunday morning here. The cat's sat on the windowsill looking out at the drizzle,
and a balmy Sunday night here, and quite warm in this study as well, I've got to say.
You see, I love it.
It's so bizarre. But as I was saying in the intro, we're here to talk about Series 9 of Doctor Who. You put together a podcast series which ran on this very channel.
I did, which
was wonderful, the Doctor Who review show. So I know you're all over it. And recently, of course, we had the Doctor Who Christmas special, which we haven't discussed yet.
No, I don't think I've discussed it with anybody, to tell you the truth.
Well, we're going to have a world first here, folks. Andy is going to tell us what he thought of the Christmas special.
Do you know what? Well, I've only actually watched it once, and I think that's the first time ever. I normally would watch it on Christmas Day, and because of the raw emotion and jollities and the odd, you know, half a pint of something, I always have to watch it again the next day, but I didn't this year, which is very unusual for me.
That's interesting.
But I had OD'd somewhat because I got the ten episode box set of the Christmas specials, all of the previous Christmas specials. Mm-hmm. So I did a marathon, which was very interesting to watch all of the other Christmas specials again before this one.
Did you watch them in order?
I did, yes.
Well, I did. Tell us what you thought when you did that.
I'm going to be honest because you know, I've always come out saying Doctor, Widow and Wardrobe is one of my favourite episodes and my favourite Christmas special, and I'd like to say here and now it still is. Still is the best one for me. The first Christmas special, the Sycorax one, it is great. It just reminds me of fun memories because at the time it was the first ever Doctor Who Christmas special, and that was just weird.
Yeah, of course.
And I just remember thinking, when it came on, and I'm thinking, this is Doctor Who that's never been seen before. It was still a novelty.
Yeah.
And it's not so much a novelty now. The Christmas specials, if they're standalone, they seem to work well. So, you know, The Runaway Bride is fine, and all through those early David Tennant ones are fine. When you get to his final ones, they're far too serious and wrapped up in continuity. And I found exactly the same with the Matt Smith ones, because the final ones were so tied up with the 50th anniversary and with Matt Smith going, it changed the way that you perceive them. And when you watch them as standalone episodes, they really don't work at all. They feel like they're part of the series, which I don't think a Christmas special should be. I like them to be bubbles or standalones or something slightly different and, you know, a little bit more chilled out and laid back and fun, which is why I like the Doctor with the Wardrobe. And it's also, I liked this year's, I think that's up there in my top two Christmas specials. I really loved it because it was just, only on one watch, but it was fun, it was funny, it was emotional. I love River. I just thought it was good. I enjoyed it. It's what they, I mean, you know, just to jump on a bandwagon, it's what they call a romp. And I'm happy with that on Christmas Day. Because and the other thing about Christmas Day in the UK is the other Christmas special we get on Christmas Day around a similar sort of time to Doctor Who, maybe on after it, is generally EastEnders, which is a soap opera, which is well known for being quite dark and depressing, and they really push the boat on Christmas Day to be as traumatic as possible.
Oh, great.
So it's nice to have something to cushion the blow. Oh, yeah, it's a Christmas tradition. There's a, you know, it's like, it's a phrase that's gone into popular culture. This is going to be the best Christmas Albert Square has ever seen.
And, so these are the episodes where they kill people off and stuff, is it?
Oh, there's trauma, fights, arguments, death, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So it's always good to have a fun episode. But again, I mean, one of the, we'll come on to this probably a little bit later. But one of the issues I did have with the previous series was I found it a bit cringy that there was too many references to the past. Too many. Let's drop in a when I say run. Let's just say reverse the polarity here. I found it a bit cringeworthy. But having said that, I did like the way that they sort of went back to the River story and I gave a future Sonic. Because a lot of people, before when they announced River was going to be in it, was going, oh, no, but her story's finished. I don't want to see River again. And I'm thinking, but it wasn't finished. We've never seen her being given that Sonic. And now we have, and I like that. I'm pleased with that.
Yeah, we'd never had the new suit and haircut scene or anything like that. It was still to come. Now, you're quite right in saying these things exist as bubbles, these Christmas episodes, and that's the way you have to watch them, because I remember it was on someone's Facebook wall recently, you know, to use your favourite one of The Widow, I always say The Witch and the Wardrobe. To use an example of that one, you have at the end of that a bomber, and they fly the bomber back through the time vortex. Now, in regular Doctor Who, I would suggest everyone would go nuts if that happened. They would say there's no way you could fly something through the time vortex like that. It'd get ripped apart. But at Christmas, hey, it's Christmas. It's okay. So that's the kind of way I take these episodes. Things happen in them that might not normally happen in other episodes. And they are, as you say, bubbles.
They've got a very different audience, yeah.
Yeah, that said, there is a lot of continuity creeping into Doctor Who in this last Christmas episode in Series 9, for example. And it's interesting because Stephen Moffat is such a student of Doctor Who and so on. Well, I mean, their team came second or third in the pub quiz when they came out here to Australia for the convention. But be that as it may, he still knows an awful lot about Doctor Who. And you would think he would remember that in the 80s when JNT was trying to cram in every possible reference he could, that it was kind of a mistake. And yet he's kind of doing that. What do you think about that?
I always go to, you know, I always go to the Tom Baker years as a point of when Doctor Who was at its best, because you had the longest serving Doctor, and yet you look at how many reoccurring monsters, characters and things were in it, and there's hardly any other than his first season. It's all very unique, and I think that's when Doctor Who's at its best, being unique, and it trying not to wrap, you know, continuity and things into it. I think it makes the universe a smaller place when you start having too many links and relationships and references. I like the idea that it's a vast place and he can go anywhere, anytime. And I think, you know, there's too many people know each other, too many common phrases are used. there's too much, you know, it's starting to, it makes it smaller rather than larger, I think. Mm. And I don't like that. It does. I know that there's nothing wrong with the fact that when they brought Doctor Who back, they were using Buffy as a framework, as a reference point. And I'm very aware that, you know, most sci-fi series are, you know, self-contained and they're in their own little universes. But I think that's what made Doctor Who different. And I think it's getting too much like them in some respects now by making it a smaller place. And that's not just with the plots and everything and the characters within the narrative of the series, but actually by referencing its own past with phrases and words we know and, you know, name-dropping little things that happened in the past in. It makes that aspect of the programme a lot smaller as well. You know, we should be getting new stuff and more original stuff. And, you know, I always say this when I'm chatting to Al, we both say this, you know, don't make it for the fans because they'll watch it anyway. And I know when we did the review show, there was an episode where I recorded a hoodoo and I had a number of my friends sat around, most who were casual viewers of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And they did point out that... you know, when it was the episode where we had the whole Pompeii thing and why the Doctor chose that face, majority of the people in the room had forgotten that even happened and that Peter Capaldi had already been in it.
Yeah, that's right.
And I just thought, what was the point of it? Why bother? Just move forward.
Yeah, particularly when it had happened in the series before and there was no explanation for it. Why Absolutely. Did we need it this time?
Ooh.
While you were talking, I was thinking back about what you were saying. Yeah, and obviously Tom Baker's era is a long time. He had Cybermen twice, he had Daleks... Oh, sorry, Cybermen once.
Cybermen once, Daleks twice.
Probably Sontarans twice. Probably had about four with the Master.
We have three Masters, I think. The Deadly Assassin's probably only the true Master story for him, because that... And you see, that did actually tackle what happens when you are on your last regeneration. You know, that was probably the biggest... continuity thing there, because it established Gallifrey, didn't it, as you know, how we see it, and
that's right,
Time Lords. It was right in his last couple of episodes when JNT had taken over and started what you were just talking about. He brought the Master back, didn't he?
Yes, and I was thinking one of those episodes with the corpsey Master also had Ainley as the Master as well, so that was the one. Yes. One story, so that's the
final one. Yeah,
yeah. And outside of that, they introduced things like Zygons, used them once. You know, all sorts of creatures, and they're just used as one-offs, and there's a lot of travelling through the galaxy, which we're not doing a lot of at the moment. We're sort of very Earth-based. Yeah, I think that could be a good reason why the Baker era is so fun to rewatch, and, you know, and was fun for people at the time, too. Going back to this episode, we have cameos. Well, I call them cameos. They're listed as the stars of the show, but I think they're cameos from the likes of Matt Lucas and Greg Davies.
Oh.
Did you think they were used well in this episode?
I liked Greg Davies because I think you can just have him on for a few lines, and he's such a... I know he was in a big robot prosthetic effect thing, but he is a very big, funny man.
Mm.
And he can't do anything but play himself, which is quite funny. He might change like personality traits, but he's always him. I thought he was very, very good, and... he works well as a psychopathic, bodiless villain.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Lucas, probably less so. I mean, you know, he was very tame, I thought. I don't know, was he in just to put his name on the credits to as a star attraction for the Christmas special?
Well, we were talking JNT earlier, and he loved his stunt casting.
Oh, he did, didn't he, with Ken Dodd and the likes. But then the Ken Dodd one was... when you watch that episode, he's actually very good and very dark, and he actually makes a lot out of that very small part, whereas I don't think the Matt Lucas was particularly memorable in it. It could have been, I think that could have been anybody, to tell you the truth.
Mm.
Any fawning sycophant.
Well, I have a question too. You were talking about the Greg Davies character, King Hydroflax, and he's in that big power armour that looks like something out of Warhammer 40,000, and they need to get his head off. And instead of doing it in a clever way, he just takes his own head off, which seems to make him very vulnerable to them just grabbing his head and running off. I know they probably wanted to move the plot along there. That was probably my biggest gripe with the episode. I mean, so many other fantastical things are happening that I just accepted. But that moment where he goes, oh, you mean like this, or whatever his line was, and plonks his head down. It's like, would you actually do that if that made you vulnerable?
I think it shows the stupidity of the character, really, doesn't it?
Mm.
So I think that's probably that point, was to pointing out that he isn't... I think that, yeah, he did show from us that that's how they know they can defeat him, and he's not all-powerful. And then his head becomes this valuable object, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there was a wild rumour when in the Radio Times, of all places, when certain publicity shots came out, that they were reckoning the headless monks were going to be involved. So you could well have got some... I think what I'm getting from undertones here is that you wanted a proper Christmas beheading. Gore and guts on Christmas Day. At least with a nice sound effect.
Well, I was just intrigued as to how they were going to do this, and then it was done for them. And, I was like, oh, okay. But then things moved along and the plot had to go other places.
It was reminiscent of... was it in Baron Munchausen where they had the... characters that could remove the heads like that?
Yes, Robin Williams was one of them.
That's right, yeah.
And he was sort of flying around as this head on a plate or on a ruff or something.
That's right, yeah.
As I recall. What a strange film. What a great film, though.
It was, yeah. Terry Gilliam.
I remember seeing it in a cinema with my mate, and there was about two other people in the cinema with us. And I don't think they liked it much. You know, they made a lot of noise and, shuffled about a lot. Whereas we thought it was great.
So potentially he was writing visually. I don't know, maybe he just wanted that particular visual. Maybe he thought that's funny and daft. Watered down Douglas Adams. There's something else that also I loved about this Christmas episode that I don't know if some people didn't like this. I haven't read any comments or feedback on it, but do you know what really thrilled me?
What's that?
We had snow in the opening titles and sleigh bells. And I always think, if you're going to do a Christmas special, do a Christmas special,
Yeah.
I used to dislike the ones where... I mean, I'm glad that the Christmassy bit was at the beginning of this and then the rest of it was just, fun time romp. But I used to dislike Christmas specials where... and the Lovejoy one's the famous one where they go to Venice and it's set in the springtime, I believe, and it's just a special. It's not a Christmas special.
Mm-hmm.
I like that you can get these things out once a year and watch them at Christmas and feel different. It's like when you bung Elf on and Muppets and stuff. I just like that. I enjoy Christmas.
Well, I can tell from the way you watched all previous 10, is it, Christmas specials?
I did, yes. I watched all 10, yeah.
Wow. Now, we've been talking about how this was a romp, and obviously I think anyone listening to this podcast will have seen it, so we don't need to go through it scene by scene. But towards the end, it sort of becomes less of a romp. We get to the point where River has done her research. She knows that the ship's going to get hit and they're all going to die because she dug the guy up who she was talking to. I thought that was a really great line. But then it all gets very sad and serious, and this is River's last night. And then, of course, we learn that the night is going to last 24 years. Yes. and so on and so forth. Did you find that sort of... It's not quite a U-turn, but it's certainly a bit of a curve from where it was going at first. Did you like that, or did it feel a bit jarring? And as a follow-up question, River herself, I felt, was kind of jarring from where she was at the start and where she was at the end. I know she didn't know the Doctor at the start, but she just seemed very mercenary compared to the River we know. Anyway, that's two loaded questions. What if we start with the seriousness of the ending first?
I liked it. I thought it was a good ending. And part of me doesn't like that... these gaping gaps are left for Big Finish and BBC Books to make money out of Doctor Who fans by shoehorning stuff into the gap.
Mm.
But then I've got no problem with people who do want to purchase those things, obviously. But to me, that I don't know if they do it because of that. Then there's also the fact that does that buy Stephen Moffat some more River episodes by having the night that long? Are they going to stay in the restaurant for 24 years, or are they going to have a base of operations now for that night?
Oh, they could, couldn't they?
I mean, I don't know if this is the place to discuss things like this, but there is a really random rumour that River might be in the next series more rather than less.
Well, that would be interesting, because I thought when she signed the Big Finish contract that it sort of signalled that when we see her on TV again, that's probably it and she's off to audio land.
There is, but there's also the point that if we're not going to get any new Doctor Who until next Christmas, we've got this a whole year, and the spin-off thing Class I've read yesterday's is due in the autumn.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a lot of months without Doctor Who, and it does keep her in the public eye, doesn't it? by promoting, because it's not just the big finish. There is a there's a book coming out as well, isn't there?
That's true. Yes, there is.
So they are keeping her out there, and I just wonder if this new deal with Big Finish with the BBC, where they're letting them use new series characters and monsters and, you know, plot lines. I just wonder if that there's a reason for that, a more, you know, subliminal marketing reason.
Well, we'll probably know if they announce a companion in the next few months. If they do that, I'd say River's probably toast. But if we go a few months and there's still no word on who the new companion is, who knows?
So I did, you know, I had, I liked the way it ended the episode and the story. It does make me contemplate what's happening in the future and stuff, deeper reasons behind it. As for River being a mercenary, I think they do keep trying to go back to this thing, and that's what they're trying to. I mean, when you think about when she used to escape from the prison and when she was, you know, did have a little bit of a violent streak to her. I think what they're trying to do is, I think what they've done with this is she started off being a bit naughty and cheeky and violent, and the doctor's realised that's what she does when he's not about. But by the end of it, when she knows it's him, he has a sort of diluting effect on her. And I think that sort of happened through the Matt Smith era. She sort of softened towards, you know, the end of his tenure as the Doctor, as opposed to when they started. And you've got to remember, she was brought up as a vigilante and as a killing machine with one specific task, wasn't she?
Yeah,
she
very
was
true.
She was raised as an assassin, basically. So she has got this conflicting thing inside her. I suppose it's just how and when they try to bring it out. I mean, again, something else I'm sure I'll come back to later is that I do feel sometimes in the modern series that they try and rush certain things and leap too far ahead to certain things. And just because Stephen Moffat as a writer knows the character inside out doesn't mean that we know every aspect of her. So I think maybe he plays with the levels of the character when he's writing her.
Yeah, and they also dropped in this thing about her having this augmented lifespan of 200-odd years, which was new to me. I don't know if that had been mentioned before.
You see, the other problem with her is it depends where they want to fit her in the River timeline. And, you know, with the story, you know, is this the last time they met? Is it not? You know, what is the story that's happened just before this as far as River's concerned? I know they tried to do it in Doctor Who magazine this month, and it's been done on a DVD before, but they always seem to sort of, again, Stephen Moffat likes to slide things about and tweak things as he pleases. So it depends where it is. I mean, if we're talking about when she still had regenerative power, then possibly that's it.
Yeah,
then again, she may well have gone, you know, on one of her archaeological trips. She might have found an eternal flame. She might have been to Khan. Who knows? these are other stories that are shoehorned in, aren't they? Like, it's not Billy. I could want to say Billy the Fish is the one they always mention, isn't it? Who's the fish? Bob the Fish or whatever he's called.
Oh. I was thinking about
Billy
it
the Fish,
the other
Billy
day.
The Fish was a cartoon strip in Viz Comic.
Right.
About a fish for a football team.
I know the reference you mean, though. Yeah, because they're always
so
going on about
these off-screen things, you know.
All right. Well, look, overall, where would you place it as an out of 10? And I guess we're only comparing it to other Christmas specials if we're keeping it in that bubble. I think you gave us a clue earlier that it might be in your top three-ish, maybe. But
Yeah, I love it. I thought it was great. It was good fun. I mean, if I watch it again, I might change my mind. But actually, on Christmas Day, it was good. It worked really well Christmas Day, and I watched it with a smile. Whether that was the glass of whiskey I had as well in my hand, I don't know. But no, it was good fun, and I was smiling and laughing through it, and I did like it. I'd go for a 9 out of 10 with it, I think, with that one.
Wow, okay. Funnily enough, I'd only give it about a 7 out of 10, but I think it's one of the better Christmas episodes, even having said that.
Yeah.
I still love things like A Christmas Carol. You know, I still can't get past Catherine Jenkins singing that song at the end of that.
Oh, it's very beautiful, but that one for me is a bit too serious, you see.
Oh, I see, okay.
You have to watch. You know, visually it's very beautiful and the sound is beautiful. And yeah, it's a great story, but for me it doesn't have the balance. I like sort of mixture of stuff in a Christmas episode, and it's too serious for me, that one.
Ah, Well, see, here's the difference between you and me, because I love that one.
I've got to watch EastEnders after. I mean, I don't have to, but it's Christmas Day.
Yeah, okay. So you'd give it a 9 out of 10.
I had to have a battle with my 16-year-old gothy niece that although she was watching Disney DVDs, I had to say, look, it stops now. We're watching Christmas Top of the Pops. And she goes, no, what kind of music is it? I said, well, the clue's in the title. It's pop music. But I hate pop music. I said, well, it doesn't matter. It's Christmas Day. We watch Top of the Pops.
That's right. Oh, 16-year-old goths. I went to school with a lot of them.
Yeah.
I did.
I was one myself as well, so can't care.
Excellent. Well, I think that puts the lid on the Christmas special. We both agree it was good fun.
Yes.
All right. Now, as producer of the Doctor Who review show, you're all across the previous series 9. So what if we quickly rattle through those episodes too? Now that, you know, there's a few months between now and whenever it started. Gosh, I think late September would have been when it first came out. Just before we get into specific ones, do you think, well, have there been any you've revisited, and or have you changed your mind, or think you might have changed your mind about any of them now having seen the whole series?
Do you know what? I've probably, again, it seems Christmas special, I've watched the episodes less than any other series.
Mm-hmm.
I watched the Dalek one quite a few times, because I just liked looking at the I liked the details. I liked spotting the Daleks, the different Daleks and things. And I did think that in the first episode, Davros' performance was sensational.
Mm.
I just thought he'd captured a dying old man fantastically.
Yeah.
I thought it was stunning. But then I'm afraid the second episode sort of took it all away from me, because it felt a bit rushed, the second episode of that. But that, I think that might be the only one I really revisited. I seem to think I did watch the earlier ones again, but I enjoyed a lot more. Considering I watched that one the most, it's one of the ones I enjoyed the least out of the whole series when I look back on it.
Interesting.
And I think I surprised myself with things I did like. And I was surprised at how good some things were that I didn't have as high expectations for.
Mm. I've got to say, in general, with New Who, as the kids like to call it, I don't do a lot of rewatching. I'll often watch something a second time, usually on the same day. Just for the purpose of reviewing for a podcast, just so I've got my facts down a bit better than just on one watch. But even then, I don't always do that. And it could be years before I feel like going back, which is so different to Classic Who, which I don't know whether it was just because I was younger, I could watch Logopolis and then watch it all again, you know, straight away, and maybe watch it again the following week. It's a very strange thing. Maybe it's just an age thing.
There's certain things that I've observed in this series that I can link back to the classic series. It seems to me that they were trying to do things that they did in the classic series a lot more, but because of the format that they've got now, it stops them from being able to do it. You know, you could watch 4 episodes of a classic Doctor Who series, because characters did develop and you got to know the characters, and it's very difficult to develop a character that you like and you can, you know, emotionally link to in 45 minutes, where you've got to fit everything else in as well. And I've got this notion that the whole series to me felt rushed.
Mm.
I think it's because there's a lot of pressure on people to create this quality product in such a short amount of time.
Mm.
And one of the things I've been chatting about this week was, you just have to watch the Sherlock special to see how much, if you put enough time and care and attention into something, how lavish and beautifully crafted something can look. I think they had the work cut out, and I wouldn't be surprised if they were exhausted, the Doctor Who production team, right at the moment.
So you don't think that the number of two-parters we had this season helped with character development? Or because each of the second episodes of all these stories were so different to the first, they were still a bit jarring from what we saw in the first? Well,
it was all a bit different. I felt that... So the Dalek one for me, I thought it would be a good two-parter. The first part was fantastic, but the second part sort of did actually go a bit silly for me, and sort of they rushed it on. too much. Instead of like making it into a movie and chopping it into two would have probably been a better way to do it. I didn't like the ending and the resolve for that. So the next one was The Base Under Siege, wasn't it? I liked that. I know a lot of people had problems with the second part of that, but I did like that one. I thought that worked well as a two-parter.
Yeah, that first part, I was going to say, particularly for character development, was just fantastic. You did actually care about the people on that base.
Yeah. I mean, I'm rushing through them now, just going on what I thought the two parts, rather than going too in-depth on them. So I'm not just going to go willy-nilly through the whole series, and that's that. But then we had the Ashielder episodes, and I think I like Maisie Williams a lot, and I think she's great in Game of Thrones. She was great in Cyberbully. I watched The Falling last week, which again was an absolutely sensational example of, you know, letting an actress do what they're good at, and it's a great, if not creepy and sinister film. And I just think that those episodes felt rushed because you've got a character who's immortal, who's going to live for a lot of years, and I think that's why her character was played so different in each episode. But I think that sort of that narrative was rushed.
Yeah,
it was a bit like we just talked about River. Each character was too different. You know, in the writers' heads, they're probably thinking, well, she's done all these adventures to get to this point, and that's why she's more confident, or why she does this. I don't think that really came across very well condensing her character into those episodes. She could have been a series thing, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think, you know, if getting Maisie Williams back was no object, they could have just had the girl who died in this series and the woman who lived next series?
Yeah, I think so. I think they should have drawn it out more. I think that was a point in a lot of the two-parters, because then did we have the Zygon one next?
That's right, yep.
Which again, now this is the one that surprised me completely. It blew me away, this one, really. And I felt at the time, and I think I might have said this on the review show, but for me that was almost like going back to 2005. If this was the first episode of New Doctor Who, it really sets it up well as like this and what the show is.
Was it making you think of something like World War III, for example?
Yeah, exactly. Done better, I think.
Oh, of course.
it did, and I liked that. I thought it was a great two-parter. And again, that's the kind of thing, though, that could have been put out across the series. You know, the fact that... Was it rushed a bit that the Zygons suddenly were unveiling themselves and had this sort of sex within them that wanted to be Zygons? Maybe that could have... I know it was a sequel, again, to the 50th anniversary, but perhaps they could have prolonged that, you know. We're rattling through along now, aren't we? Then did we get the Matt Gaetis one?
Yes, Sleep No More.
So for me, the Matt Gaetis one is one that should have been a two-parter.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the one that was... When I read the interviews about it, which, of course, a lot of people won't have done, I'm aware of that, but I read interviews with him at the time, and some of the concepts and ideas that were in that episode sounded very much like things from, you know, certain Tom Baker stories and Sylvester McCoy stories, a bit more political.
Mm-hmm.
And when you actually watch the episode... All of this big thing he'd been interviewed about was like covered in one line, and I think and character development in that was rushed. So I thought that one should have been a two-parter. What do we go to after that? Where are we coming to now?
We go to Face the Raven.
Now thinking back to that, now all I can think of is Diagon Alley.
Well, yeah, Diagon Alley, Ashielder's back.
Yeah, I don't think that one really did much for me.
Rigsy's back.
I think it was. Well, you see, is this the one where? Is this the one where Clara dies at the end? On the Graham Norton show, the night before,
yes,
Peter Capaldi was on and he just said, oh yeah, it's a sad one tomorrow, Clara dies. And I thought that was the stupidest bit of marketing ever.
Mm.
You know, because normally they're so cautious and careful on shows, so he's obviously been allowed to say it, and I thought it was just ratings chasing.
Well, I was going to say, before we get to the last two episodes, do you think at that point they were really looking for a bump in the ratings? Because they were so down this series.
Definitely. And I don't think they should be bothered about that, because, you know, those of us in the know that people watch it on iPlayer and on the computer. I watch so much telly now, not when it's on.
Mm.
And save it up. And it just, I don't know, it just confuses me as to why people are still obsessed with the companies are obsessed with ratings. And I thought it was just a silly thing. And it, you know, fair enough. I'm a fan, and it annoyed me. And then people I know who just like you know, they don't get as bogged down in you know the history of Doctor Who as I do. They just watch it for fun. A friend of mine, you know, messaged me and said, "I've just watched Graham Norton. They've just totally spoiled it."
I guess people, they want metrics. They want to hang on to figures and things. It's like, you know, but I never agree with them myself. It's like someone with 10,000 Twitter followers, and you think, well, how many of those 10,000 Twitter followers aren't bots who are actually interested in what you're saying? They haven't got you sort of muted. You know, they're just wanting a follow back from your account. I would rather have 100 people I have a great relationship with than 10,000 people. But to some people, they just want to see the stat. They just want to see 10,000 followers. Oh, they're really good, them, on Twitter. You know, you with 100 followers, no, you're hopeless. Ooh. And it's just not right, you know. Something I was saying on some of my bits on the review show that you produced was I wanted to see, well, I was seeing this as almost a cult series within a cult series. If that made sense. And I want to think in years to come, particularly after Capaldi goes, people will look back to this series and go, geez, that wasn't bad, was it? You know, that deserved more than the 5 point whatever million most of the episodes were getting. Particularly as like the previous Christmas episode, to talk of last Christmas, I think had about 8 million something, you know?
But this is, I mean, the TV viewing on Christmas Day was down as a whole.
In this Christmas just gone?
Yeah. But I do think that's because people do things different. I mean, it's like I say, my niece was watching DVDs, which I found totally strange. You can do that any day.
Yeah, watch that's
Christmas true. Telly. And then my nephew's there on his tablet watching cartoons. You know, everyone's sort of doing their own thing now. It's a different way of doing it.
Yeah, it certainly is. Our Christmases have been getting smaller and smaller at home, and we don't have quite the TV culture in Australia in general as the UK. I think this is why the UK does TV so well. I think there is more of a focus on TV and such. I commented on this to someone just recently. It might have been on Mark Cockrum's Nerdology podcast. I was saying how the UK makes such good TV, and in Australia we have good actors and we have good behind-the-scenes people. And we have all the components that can make good TV. We just don't do it all that often. A lot of Australian TV is terrible. And then in the UK, there's just this culture of television. And at Christmas, there are Christmas specials for all these shows. Most of our shows don't do Christmas specials, you know.
Well, the other big thing is, and I need to mention this because I've not mentioned it on any podcast. And it'd be interesting if you got this. But the other thing is, there's certain things that happen building up to Christmas telly. One of them is the double issue Radio Times, which the Radio Times is a TV listing mag that it is actually very expensive still, as I found out when I bought it. But, you know, when I was little, you only bought it at Christmas.
Right.
And it used to last for a fortnight, and you'd underline all the programmes you wanted to watch. I don't know, I bought it this year, and it was something like £5 or something like that.
Wow.
I didn't know, because I bought that and a chocolate bar or something. And when they said, oh, it's £5.70, I'm thinking, it's an expensive chocolate bar. But the other thing, and they did it earlier than ever this year, they did it right at the beginning of December, is you get the Christmas trailer on, which I'm sure was available on iPlayer, but this year it was like a little adventure called Sprout Boy. Did you get this?
No.
Right. So on the BBC, they changed the logo and everything to a Christmassy. So you get the BBC One covered in snow and robins. They really go to town on it. And they launched this trailer after EastEnders one night, which is like the biggest soap. So everyone's watching. And suddenly the logo changed and they said, and now let's go and see what's coming up this Christmas with Sprout Boy. And there's this little CG animation, this little sprout, and a very familiar voice comes on and tells a little poem, and it's Peter Capaldi's voice.
Yeah.
You're very aware of. And it's a little story called Nobody Loves a Sprout. And this little sprout goes to various houses and they kick him out because no one likes sprouts. And he goes to a toy maker and no, he doesn't want to know. So he kicks the sprout out into the cold. Oh. And this sad little sprout's walking along and suddenly a tree parts, some trees part, and her face pops out. And it says, it's not Peter Capaldi's voice that's been narrating the poem. It's the Doctor. And there's a computer animated version of the Doctor that welcomes Sprout Boy to a big Christmas meal where there's lots of other characters from BBC programmes, all CG, sat around a big table pulling crackers. So you've got, I don't know, I'll throw some names out. You've got Doc Cotton from EastEnders and Will.i.am's there from The Voice, and there's all these, you know, oh, Graham Norton was there and Sherlock, all CG rendered. And so the Doctor did the Christmas, this whole Christmas trailer. So it might still be on iPlayer, but it'll definitely be on YouTube. Was like a little bonus Christmas episode.
I will look that up. That sounds fantastic. And already I'm thinking, and tell me if you had the same thought, when I finally see this, the first thing I think will probably be, wow, they should do a CG Doctor Who series.
Absolutely. It's not just that, but you can see that that's at the beginning of December, so that's how telly gets us in the UK excitable.
Yeah.
And then they'll put up loads of clips of all the Christmas specials that are coming in, little bits and bobs, and it's you know, it just gets you really excited. And then you start, then you still, even, you know, even in this day and age of iPlayers and set-top boxes, we still underline all the programs we want to watch.
I think it must be a weather thing, because, you know, to sit indoors and watch TV would be just bizarre for us to do at Christmas, because it's just so hot and you want to be outside and, you know, and even eating Christmas dinner can be a chore. You eat it and then you instantly feel sick. Well, if you've had a traditional type dinner, a lot of people now just go for salads and bowls of prawns and things like this. But yeah, I think it just has made this culture that I just find so fascinating, and have since I was a little kid watching shows on the ABC here, which is our version of the BBC. And they would buy mostly BBC shows. And so I grew up watching all this stuff, but in completely the wrong climate. Completely the wrong surrounds, but I was still always fascinated by it and loved it, you know, Doctor Who and many, many other shows.
Yeah.
All right, shall we move on to the final two episodes of the series? We might want to spend a little more time on these, because
I rather fun, didn't I, just by saying how I felt about a two-parters, but I can expand on most. Yeah, the last two episodes, quite ironically, the television's on in this room with the sound down, and it's just on a random channel. Which is called Challenge, which shows old episodes of game shows, because I was watching Robot Wars earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The programme that's on at the moment is a programme called Nightmare.
Ah, yes.
In the 80s was a kids' game show, which was done with very dodgy computer graphics.
Yes, it was.
And where they walk around a castle. And when we had the... Now, I always get these two mixed up. Is it Heaven Sent, the episode where it was a doctor on his own?
That's right.
Right, so in that episode, all I could think of all the way through it was Nightmare. Because it was like he was in this game show with various tasks and things.
That, and the fact that when they did cut to some CG of gears turning and things, they looked really CG. They didn't look real at all.
Yeah, that's the thing that spoiled the episode for me, because I think it's almost... One of the bad things about that and the Mark Gatiss episode is they sold the technical format of them beforehand rather than sold the episode. And I think that was a big problem for me. And I know it wasn't for other people, because some people have loved that episode. I can see why, you know, the bits where the Doctor is on his own and talking and stuff, yeah, it's great scripts and great performing. But for me, it really was spoilt by the castle and the shots. Hmm. Especially because I use a computer program every day called SketchUp to draw buildings and things, and it's most basic level and basic rendering. It didn't look far off some of the shots we were getting of the castle, which I thought was a shame and spoilt it.
Mm.
Especially when I know how good they are. And this goes back to me saying things were rushed. A couple of extra days with the computer guys and changed the lighting a bit and up the rendering, it would have been a lot more slicker, and it almost looked a bit disjointed, some of the cuts of the shots. I couldn't really believe he was in that castle when we were getting the aerial shots and things.
Hmm. I guess, did they really spend so much money on things like Hellbent, getting them out in the desert and other places, that they had to really cut back on episodes like this? I don't know.
I think they've had a tough time.
Mm.
I think they're trying... I think again, you've mentioned JNT. I know they don't really talk about this a lot, but I wouldn't be surprised. Knowing what the BBC is like at the moment, because on the news we get a lot of news about, you know, cuts to the BBC, and they're ditching quite big sporting events now. They've just got rid of their Formula One coverage, which has been like a huge thing for them for years. they're ditching things like that to save money.
Yeah.
So they are in, they have got financial difficulties, and I think that they're doing their best, and that's why it's so exhausting for them, I think. And it does go back to the 80s when JNT was, you know, spent all his money on the Leisure Hive, didn't he, and then had nothing left.
Yeah.
So it is, budget management must be very difficult, I think.
Now, Capaldi has said he's doing a full series for Series 10, so we take him at his word that it's probably 12 episodes. Do you think in the future, beyond that, because I think these issues with the BBC and funding and such might be ongoing, that Doctor Who might become a six-part mini-series every year or something like that?
It could be less even, though, because, again, Sherlock is something I compare it to. There's certain flagship programmes with the BBC, Doctor Who being one and Sherlock being another. Mm-hmm. And I seem to think they've got the balance right with Sherlock. And I think there's a lot more people. I think they've got a good team dynamic working on it. But a lot of care and attention is going into it. Yet you get these 3 movie-length episodes every couple of years.
Do you think that works, though, because that's how it's kind of always been with Sherlock, so people accept it, whereas with Doctor Who, having its 50-odd years of, you know, multiple story seasons, people expect something different?
Yeah, but, I mean, it's like I've been saying, these 45-minute episodes are very different to four-parters.
Mm.
I don't know, I think they'd have to look at how other series and things work, and how often other series happen. You know, it'd be interesting to see what happens with X-Files and Twin Peaks.
True.
You know, are these the models for TV series now? It's all right using Buffy as a starting point, but that's a very old way of making TV now.
That's right. It's a whole different kind of pacing, it's a whole different kind of writing, because when you take a four-parter and strip the starts and finishes out, it's just over 90 minutes, and a two-part modern Doctor Who is, say, 90 minutes. So they're the same length, but they feel completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Briefly, though, to touch on this story, I thought this was a cracking story. I always thought it would be when I heard Peter Capaldi was doing a solo kind of episode. And yet, we talk of ratings not meaning much. Well, the AI for this was 80, and it was the second lowest of the whole series. Yet, I thought this was a really cracking episode.
The thing is, I say that they promoted the fact that it was a one-hander. But they didn't. But they only promoted that to fandom, really. We read about it in Doctor Who magazine and online.
Mm.
I don't really recall it being saying this is just the Doctor, you know, in the general telemags and things like that. It's a change of pace for your casual viewer. I did record something for the review show that's actually on the cutting room floor. It never got used.
Ooh.
Which is I did have people around on that episode, and my godsons were there, who were 14 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be very interesting straight after the episode to find out exactly what they thought, you know, to see if they felt it was complicated or they didn't understand it. And they did. They both loved it. They thought it was great. Awesome. And they did totally get the concept and everything within it. So I thought, oh, that's very good. But I did think maybe for some people, though, it's a change of pace. I mean, they're used to playing single-player computer games, maybe being one-hander characters themselves.
Yeah.
So that's something to do with it, but I don't know, maybe it was too different for some people.
Well, speaking of some people not getting it, did you come across a lot of people who seemed to think that at the end of it, the Doctor was 4 billion years old?
Yes. Yeah, I think people didn't quite get that he was in the time dial. And that also, when it comes to Time Lords and Time Lord technology and concepts like the Time War and even concepts like day and night, it doesn't really exist. Hours and minutes and seconds, it's sort of all out the window.
Yeah.
So, yes, I did find a lot of people thought he was 4 billion years old and that he'd been doing that for 4 billion years.
Yeah, and yet every time he reappeared, he was a clean skin. He was there for the first time and had to learn it all over again.
Yeah.
And yet, in the next episode, it was kind of reinforced when Clara's saying, you know, how long did you wait for me, Doctor, or whatever the line was. And it was like he had actually waited and battled through 4 billion years for her, which in one sense he had, but in the sense people are thinking he had, no, he really hadn't.
There is some interest in Stephen Moffat's show notes bit in Doctor Who magazine this month. He does go some way to answering a lot of questions about that episode, because obviously a lot was sent in by readers. And he does address the fact that he does feel that that the Doctor, the different Doctors, did evolve as it went on, because there were certain plot holes that he'd noticed himself that could only be explained by the fact that, you know, over that time the different Doctors did change.
Was one of them the nudie exactly. Doctor?
Nudie Doctor was mentioned.
For the people at home, the Doctor comes across a set of clothes, but he hasn't been there before. Where did the clothes come from? One of his past selves must have done the rest of the episode nude.
That's right.
Or wrapped in a curtain or something.
I must admit, I've sort of not really read into that too in depth, because I think I've always found over the last couple of years, when you start asking too many questions about an episode, like a dragon being in the moon. And you start asking too many questions about it, I think that's the kind of thing that spoils the enjoyment. And I think that's why I like things like Doctor Who's in the Wardrobe and Victory of the Daleks, and other people don't, because I don't tend to ask too many questions about it, go too in-depth. I just, if it's entertained me, I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, the moon that is hatched that's larger than the creature that...
Yes, and that's just reminded me of something else, that after we've finished discussing the episodes, there's another Christmas special that's been totally missed that I need to tell you about.
Oh, okay. Well, let's rattle on through Hellbent. The Doctor's back on Gallifrey. Did you enjoy the design of Gallifrey? I thought it looked stunning.
Yeah, the design's great. I like the design of Gallifrey.
It sounds like there's something maybe you weren't happy with.
I didn't really like the episode. I don't know. I think bringing Gallifrey into it wasn't necessary. He's, you know, since 2005, he's been sad at the loss of his people and the loss of his planet, which I always thought was a bit, well, fair enough, your people have gone, but, you know, you've always said you didn't like them and you ran away.
Mm.
So, you know, why are you so bothered? And I did like it when Gallifrey wasn't part and parcel of it, because I did think the 80s Gallifrey stories, again, like I said earlier about other things, they shrunk the universe rather than grow it. So I don't know, it felt a bit like going back to that to me, but I just didn't see it. You know, he got back to Gallifrey and, you know, it seemed a bit odd that then he exiled the president. I mean, you know, I don't understand why you're bothered.
Mm.
And he still doesn't seem really to like anybody there. And the whole point of the episode seemed to be more about the whole Clara thing and you know, catching her between breaths, which I thought was a great idea and concept.
Mm.
And I knew Clara would be back and that they would do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something Moffaty and clever. But I don't know. I felt the whole Gallifrey bit was a bit shoehorned in and wasn't really necessary.
But what about the hybrid? Can I even mention that word? You know, is it the Doctor? Is it Ashilda? Is it the Doctor and Clara together? If it is the Doctor and Clara, why does Hartnell run away when he never met Clara? Or I guess he met Clara when he was actually stealing the TARDIS, if we believe the new continuity.
This is the ask questions thing again, isn't it?
Well, it is, isn't it? But it's a question that I almost have to ask to understand what's happening.
Something I always ponder in my head, and I've done this through Classic Who as well, that every time he does something, if you think about it, it alters previous adventures. There's always little bits like that that have changed things that have previously happened. And I think even more so now in the new series, where they've actually realised, oh, it's a time travel series, he can meet people before he's previously met them. I think that's what starts making you ask these questions. And because we're frustrated and at how it's been done. This is one of the things with Doctor Who fans. We can forget that it is an entertainment programme at the end of the day.
Mm.
And we can talk about things like this for hours, can't we? And this is where you start coming up with like things that happened off screen that you don't know about, and you know, scenes that they didn't show. You have to start inventing all sorts of things to make you feel better, don't you?
You do. Speaking of, is Clara and Ashilda in the TARDIS the next big finish in about 10 years' time?
Absolutely, yes.
Once Maisie's finished with Game of Thrones. And
I think you'll find that there's a series there and there's books there, yeah. I can always feel myself groaning when things like that happened.
Yeah, well...
I did like... I mean, you know, talking about design, that Type 40 blank TARDIS interior.
Yes.
Really good.
I hope they've saved that. I hope they've made that into a display at their museum or something so they can reuse it, because it was beautiful.
It was. And I like Kashilda and Clara being off between breaths in a 50s diner. It was very it was very Sapphire and Steel.
Well, you said you didn't like the episode much, but it sounds like there were parts of it you
liked. I like those bits. The whole bit that I didn't like was the Gallifrey bit. I just didn't. It doesn't do it for me, the Gallifrey story. Especially when he was so excited about finding it at the end of last season.
Yes. Yeah. I remember Matt Smith in the 50th, you know, when he's thinking, oh, my destiny is to find Gallifrey. You know, his voice is almost cracking as he's saying it.
That was one of the interesting bits about his regeneration story, saying that the Christmas specials that work standalone don't work. And that one doesn't as a standalone, really. But when you think about it in the continuity of the series, the bit where the crack actually opens in the sky and the Time Lords grant him some new regenerations is very interesting. And it just goes to show how powerful they are and why they're hiding and things like that. It never seems to sort of... Again, it's a bit like the Daleks. It never seems to follow through when you actually get it.
Yeah.
You know, the actual sort of like big verbal introduction, preamble to Daleks, Time Lords, etc., sends you quaking with shivers down your spine and absolutely terrified. And when it actually happens, it's a bit...
I know what you mean. All right, well, looking back over the whole series, as I've said, I think it's a cult series within a cult series. There was only one episode I really, truly disliked. It was the Gatiss episode. Otherwise, I was quite entertained by the whole thing. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I thought it was a good series. I had some issues with... I mean, I've had issues with Peter Capaldi both series. His first series, he almost seemed too dark and grumpy. And again, this series, he seemed to have gone totally David Tennant, Matt Smith, you know, lively, sprightly, quirky Doctor.
Mm.
And I almost thought that was a bit much some episodes. But as a series, yeah, it was a really good series, yeah.
Yeah.
I do think it's got rushed bits, and I think there's bits that could have been done better, and I hope Arrest does it good. Because some of the, some of those Matt Smith episodes, they were so good and slick and beautiful and clever. I sort of think that it's lost that. And I'm hoping that maybe they're going to, you know, if Peter Jackson is indeed coming on board, I'm hoping that getting, you know, these different directors in is going to, you know, it's not just about writers. It's a lot more about directing and the way it looks for me.
Yeah, that's true. I think
that needs a little tweak. Especially, you know, I mean, it was things like when the Zygons were killed in that episode and they turned into those little rooty sort of tumbleweedy things. And that their technology didn't seem to work in daylight. I think little things like that need attention and looking at a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. I think we both like the series then, although we can both pick holes in it if we get too picky.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Now, before we go, you said there was a Christmas special you had to tell me about.
Absolutely. And I don't understand why this hasn't been shouted about. So Professor Brian Cox,
yes,
who has done, for the 50th anniversary, he did a little TV show about the science of Doctor Who.
It was great.
It was great. Well, he has a radio show in the UK, which is available all over the world, I should think, on the iPlayer, that he does with a comedian called Robin Ince, who's very interested in science. And the radio show is called Infinite Monkey Cage. And every week they get a number of guests on, which is normally a scientist and normally someone from the entertainment world. And there's been some fantastic ones on in the past, like people like Brian Blessed on and things. Anyway, I didn't even know the theme of this one, but I listen to the iPlayer when I go to bed, you know, and I'm sat, you know, contemplating the world. And I normally pick a comedy show, and I saw there'd been a Christmas special of Infinite Monkey Cage on Christmas Day.
Okay.
I thought, oh, I'll listen to that, and I put it on, and it's a Doctor Who Science Of special.
No.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
So... that was well hidden.
Very well hidden. Even I hadn't heard about it, and I like to think I hear about things.
It is really good. No, it hadn't appeared on any websites. I'd not even seen it mentioned in Doctor Who magazine. So it was just absolute luck that I found out, and it's really good. It's good fun. Because they say it's Christmas Day, so we're here to discuss the true meaning of Christmas, which of course is the Doctor Who Christmas special. And they go off and talk about the science of Doctor Who.
Oh, well, I'm going to hunt that down.
Also, with it being Christmas Day, they've also got a vicar on as well, who's very funny because he almost turns it into a very vicary style thought for the day. I think he compares the TARDIS to the Son of God. And
wow, I've got to hunt this down.
So you've got Sprout Boy to watch,
yes,
and you've got the Infinite Monkey Cage.
Well, there are two really good tips for our listeners.
Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, for coming on the inaugural episode.
Yes.
And when people aren't hearing you on future episodes, where else can they hear you?
Well, I mean, you probably there's no schedule for this at all, but randomly on a podcast feed called Top Geek, you'll hear me and other familiar voices popping up and rambling about things.
And what kind of things? Pop culture things, sciencey things?
And we've done, we do a produced show every now and again when material's together, because we like lots of different voices, very much like the Doctor Review show. And there is a special of that coming up at some point, which is going to feature your good self.
Ooh.
Talking about Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh, I remember that.
Another treat is that I've got some good interviews that I've still got with an astronaut. I've got an interview with an astronaut. How exciting is that?
Excellent.
So we've got that coming up, and then me and Al Noh, we did a little ramble about Series 9 of Doctor Who, which is up and about. And any time in the next couple of weeks or whenever this has gone out, around this time, you'll probably find us rambling about the Sherlock Christmas special.
Which I have yet to see myself. I know that's terrible.
You heard it's terrible.
No, I know it's terrible that I haven't watched it. Although I have heard some people say that was terrible, and then I've heard other people say that was absolutely brilliant. So, you know, I don't know what to expect.
Well, I thought it was brilliant, but it doesn't come across like that on the podcast, but we end up comparing it to Doctor Who as well, so that comes into it.
Oh, well, listeners, get into that, Top Geek. Hmm. And where can they find that?
It's on a Podbean feed, so if you just type in Top Geek, you should find it, hopefully.
Awesome.
Listen while you can, because it's just changed. Some of the stuff isn't going to be there forever now, and there's some amazing things people haven't heard on it. Because I couldn't believe that so few people have heard. There's an episode where I get to talk to Gerry Anderson's son.
That's a good episode.
And he talks so wonderfully about his dad and his dad's legacy. So if you like Gerry Anderson stuff, and we go for... The thing about Top Geek is we try to go for more obscure stuff. So we don't rant on about Cats and Scarlet and Thunderbirds. We're talking about the stuff that's coming up with Gerry's company, and also some of the sort of... stuff that gets forgotten sometimes, like Terrorhawks and Space Police, Space Precinct, that kind of thing.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, thank you again for joining us on this first episode, and we hope to speak again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me, and good luck and all who sail in here.
Thanks, mate.
The A to Z of Doctor Who. A. Absorbeloff. V. Some people will tell you that 2006's Love and Monsters was the very worst episode of Doctor Who ever, a Doctor Light comedy episode forged in hell by madmen smeared in excrement and slurry. These people will go on to tell you that the very worst and most contemptible part of the whole sorry nonsense was Northern British nostalgia monkey Peter Kay wearing a tight rubber suit and a loincloth, running a bit like a crap fatty. That is what some people will tell you. And that the monster was designed by a child, of all things. Me, I quite like that episode. Ace. To many, Sophie Aldred's Ace remains a powerful memory of late 80s girl power, as the plucky Perivalian smacked a Dalek upside the head, armed with only a special baseball bat. an iconic role model of feminist empowerment and a companion who really kept the Doctor honest and proved in many ways to be his equal. This teenage working-class tearaway was memorably portrayed by late 20-something middle-class actor Sophie Aldred, of whom less charitable critics will imply that she was somewhat out of her depth in the role, and indeed in virtually any role. But people are mean about just about everyone who's ever been in Doctor Who, so don't listen, Soph. Just look at Colin Baker. Just look at Jenny Thomasin. Adipose. Just take this pill and all your fat will drop off. And people fell for that? Seriously? Seriously? Adric. Some people would poke fun at Alzarian stowaway and artful dodger-like Adric. Companion to Tom Baker's Fourth Doctor and Peter Davison's pleasant open-faced fifth. And Josh and rib you about how he was awful, awful, awful and portrayed by a young man who should never have been allowed to stand in front of a TV camera. But just repeating this sentiment would be easy and lazy, like shooting fish in a barrel. So instead, in order to offer something fresh and new for the jaded listeners out there, I'd like to devote the rest of this entry to listing the many qualities of both Adric and the actor involved, Matthew Waterhouse, that were not completely and utterly awful. Alex Kingston. Doctor Who fans are a contrary bunch. Give them £1 million and they'll grumble it's not in dollars or something. Give them constant change, renewal and innovation and they'll moan that things aren't the same. Give them the knockdown dead stunning Alex Kingston and that indescribable cascade of insane curls and they'll moan that she's in the show too much, her story arc doesn't make sense, her knowing winks and cheeky innuendos are too much for a family show. And the whole bit about the character being able to regenerate is absolute heresy. To these narrow-minded, short-sighted fools, I make the same sound as I do whenever Alex Kingston appears on my TV, which is sort of wistful, gargling whimpers of unalloyed desire. Then often I get a bit of dribble just in the corner of my mouth. Sort of, oh, like that. Lovely. Alien bodies. Opinion is divided on the BBC Eighth Doctor novels because a couple of people didn't think they were completely and utterly awful. One of very few highlights in the 9 years of monthly publishing was the novel Alien Bodies by Lawrence Miles, which bucked the trend in the novel range by actually featuring a couple of original ideas, of which at least three were rather good. Do you need, however, to go back and read it now? No. All-consuming fire. One of the more interesting of the Virgin New Adventures series of novels saw the Seventh Doctor, Ace and Benny, team up with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Or sort of. In a thrilling adventure, Holmes is vital for the first 150 pages, which are set in Victorian London, and then spends the last part of the book, when we move to an alien planet, hopelessly floundering about out of his depth. It's presumably for this reason that in the recent Big Finish adaptation, Holmes is portrayed by Nick, not Canon, Briggs. Alpha Centauri. An accusation often levelled at the Pertwee era is its po-faced humourlessness, but then you see this comedy alien that looked a bit like someone's knob, and the argument is forever deflated. Amy Pond. Amy Legs joined the TARDIS in the episode The Eleventh Hour, which is, pound for pound, possibly the best episode of New Who so far, and I'll fight anyone who says different. The flame-haired poutstress shouted and glowered her way through 2.5 series accompanied by her ineffectual but marvellous husband Rory and her long, long Scottish legs, which many people found distracting. It's very telling that at the moment of his regeneration, Matt Smith's 11th Doctor even enjoyed a small waking daydream where he and Amy Pond had a bit of a snog. Who amongst us cannot claim to have had the same fantasy? Also, it turned out that Amy was River Song's mother. Blimey. Andrew Cartmell. Andrew Cartmell was the visionary script editor of the Sylvester McCoy era, apart from the story Time and the Rani, as he's often quick to point out. He tried his best to steer the show in fresh and exciting directions, despite almost everyone else involved in the production trying their damnedest not to follow him. By season 26, which is good, no, really, it is, his vision was apparent and the show, while a ratings flop, was at least marching back towards being absolutely brilliant. Cartmell went on to write some great new adventure novels and, like so many of the new adventure writers, is now launching a series of crime novels. This one's about jazz and vinyl, not Evil from the Dawn of Time or anything we've come to associate him with thus far. Cartmell also came up with the eponymous Cartmell Master Plan, which is all to do with how the Doctor is far more than just an ordinary Time Lord. He's Rey's father. He trained Kylo Ren. He taught the young Rassilon to dance and was, for a time, the lead guitarist in Guns N' Roses. Or something, I don't know. Read Lungbarrow. Angels. The Weeping. If they were that clever, they'd just come for us in our sleep. So why haven't they conquered the Earth yet? Jerks. Anthony Ainley. No one really knows anything about the mysterious Anthony Ainley, least of all his unofficial biographer Karen Louise Hollis. Born in 1896, although no one seems absolutely certain, Ainley's only job ever was to play the master, otherwise he was to be found playing cricket. So with two passions in life, cricket and being part of Doctor Who, you'd have thought he was a massive fan of Peter Davison's Fifth Doctor. But no, he kept turning up in the show and trying to kill him. Either with his tissue compression eliminator, his demonic Castrovalvan tapestry, or in the case of Time Flight, by making the Doctor fatally prolapse from laughing at how awful the Master's Khalid disguise was. Ainley went on to bother Doctor 6 and 7 too, before the end of the classic era spelled the end of Ainley's reign of terror. He died in 2004, although no one seems to know very much about this either, so maybe he didn't. Who knows? Two little-known Ainley facts are that he'd always double-take if you mentioned syrup of figs within his earshot, and that his favourite political party from history were the Whigs.
We interrupt this programme to bring you a special report.
Hey there everyone, Rob here with a quick public service announcement on behalf of the Letter Lords. Who are the Letter Lords, I hear you ask? Well, you're about to hear them, so I won't steal any of their thunder, except to say on their behalf that the following segment does contain some information that is now out of date, so no need to write in. The Letter Lords are well aware of what's happened in the Hooniverse over the past couple of weeks since they recorded this segment. Everything's fine. So without any further ado, let's get into it.
Hello and welcome. We are the Letter Lords. So who are the Letter Lords, you may well ask? Well, I'm Jim from the Crinoid podcast, where my old mate Martin and I do very lengthy reviews of normally classic Who stories, equal parts commentary, review, and puerile jokes. And you may also have heard me guesting on another podcast featuring my good friend and fellow Letter Lord, Mr. Robert Marshall Amplifier Fleming.
Indeed. Hello, I'm Bob Fleming from the Progter Who podcast, the show, apparently, that seeks to fuse a world of prog rock and Doctor Who together into one podcast. Basically, it's me, Mark Atkinson, Craig Stimson, getting together and having a good chinwag about Doctor Who and breaking that relentless talking up by playing a few prog rock songs in between. And sometimes joined by my fellow Letter Lord, Jim Cameron. He occasionally, he'd do quite a bit on us, don't you? He'd do quite a bit on Prog to Who.
Yeah, you can't get rid of me, really, can you?
Yeah, like a bad rash, Jim. But a nice one. It's one where you scratch it and think, oh, that's relieving.
I'm glad to offer you some relief. I don't feel quite so well now. Never mind. Okay, so why are we here? Why are we the Letter Lords? Well, our brief is to discuss the more interesting letters, texts and tweets that get sent into the official Doctor Who magazine. Oh. So, without further ado, let's get stuck into the latest issue, number 495. So, let's start with a tweet from Dave Boy Brooks. He says, how about starting a new series with a Christmas episode, then followed by a series? No competition from the X Factor, etc.
When I read this, I was like, that is genius. And also, I think that there's been many conversations on the internet about this, whereby they're going to start possibly filming Series 10 in May. And, you know, the first episode will be at Christmas time. Which I thought, as a Doctor Who fan being selfish, wow, that's ages. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that will work brilliantly well, because, yeah, like he says, we've got no X Factor. There's not a lot on ITV probably at that time. So viewing figures, well, live viewing figures would potentially go up. I think that's a pretty good call from Dave Boy Brooks there. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I can't see a lot wrong with that. It would certainly calm people's nerves about these overnight figures. I know they're kind of less important, but nevertheless, you know, the industry does look at this stuff, and you kind of wonder what questions are being asked in various places. The other thing about that, of course, is you're more likely to catch more casual viewers this way, because the kind of people who might watch Strictly or The X Factor and not bother to catch up with Doctor Who by whatever means. So it's easier now than ever, but you know, you've still got to make that step, and if you're a casual viewer, you may not do that. So I think that could be pretty good. And the whole argument about Doctor Who being shown when it's dark is kind of, we're led to believe that's why it starts in the autumn these days. But of course, 13 weeks from January is going to be mostly in the dark anyway. So, and am I right in thinking that the Pertwee era and early Tom Baker era would transmit in the beginning of the year? I think they did, didn't they?
I believe you are, and it makes perfect sense, because it's sort of more, you know, literally a captured audience, isn't it? Because, you know, it's not summer, people aren't going out into the garden and, you know, forgetting about television. You know, it becomes a bit more important thing for family time, because it's cold, it's raining, it's whatever outside and dark, that people will, you know, families will sit around and watch Doctor Who. Yeah, no, I think that, in fact, that just makes the most sense ever. There's only me, I think, and you, and pretty much all Doctor Who fans going, I can't wait a year for the new assistant and all, you know, what's gonna come. It's a long time, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But I mean, you could see how this could quite conceivably actually happen, couldn't it?
Oh yeah, it makes absolute commercial sense, I think, and practical sense, I think.
Well, if they start to record in May, which it seems they're going to do, then we won't get much out much before Christmas, and you know, it would make sense to kind of just carry on. You know, maybe a couple of weeks break, maybe, but you know, I don't see any reason why we couldn't just carry straight on the next week.
Crack on.
Go straight in it, because you know, they'll have all been filmed by then, or at least the vast majority will. So, yeah. Well done, Dave Boy Brooks. I hope somebody's listening somewhere. But
I really do as well. I think that's really good. Yeah, no, I think it's spot on. Well, our second letter is from Jacob Lockett, and it was an email. I was quite disappointed when it was revealed that the Doctor had been trapped within his confession dial during the events of Heaven Sent. Up until that discovery, I was convinced that he was stuck in the Death Zone, an arena of nightmares and monsters that was first seen in the 1983 The Five Doctors. However, despite my error, I still would have preferred the inclusion of the Death Zone in this narrative. It just fits so perfectly and seamlessly within the premise of the plot. I also think that its incorporation would have made Heaven Sent even more memorable than it was already, providing an excellent service to all time fans and giving the production team a good enough reason to bring back the ever-popular Rastan Warrior robot. Stephen definitely missed a trick there. Well, I see where you're coming from, Jacob. I do. As in, I love the idea of the Death Zone, and I love the Rastan Royal Robot. But I adored Heaven Sent. I thought it was ace. And I think Jim's probably in a similar camp to me with this, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting idea. And I did like the Death Zone when it appeared in The Five Doctors. And, you know, I could see it coming back sometime. It might be, you know, an interesting arena to, you know, to chuck some characters and some adversaries in there. But for me, it was the fact that the castle that the Doctor was incarcerated in was really more of kind of Matrix technology, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's, you know, a more kind of surreal thing, rather than just dumping someone in a real place.
Yeah.
He's in somewhere where, you know, anything can happen, really, because, you know, anything's been controlled by whoever's controlling it. The other thing, of course, is that depending where you are in the death zone, I suppose, the Doctor could have looked out the castle window and known where he was, or being able to have a good chance of working out where he was. You know, particularly, he sees and hears the tower, you know, that terrible Rassilon's horn that you heard 5 minutes, five Doctors. But, I mean, if you could see that, or even just the landscape, might give him enough of a clue. And I think one of the good things about Heaven Sent was the fact he didn't know where he was to start.
And there was something changing all the time. It made it more eerie. And I think when you said the Matrix, then I think that was the sort of add to its surrealism, really. And that's why I thought it was all along. And I agree with with the normal. The Death Zone wouldn't have meant anything to anyone apart from obviously us limited classic Doctor Who fans. As much as like you say, it's a great concept. But he would have known where he was, and it would have dragged a normality back to it, which I don't think. Which probably would have dragged the episode down, really. However, I would love to have seen a man in Lycra spitting arrows out of his hands and moving like lightning. That would have been awesome. Yeah. I do. The Rastan Warrior Robot, I need to talk about this. I found him amazingly scary when I was a kid. The fact he could move like lightning, because in my eyes he did. And then when you go back to it now, it's pretty much of the 80s, the campest, strangest villain of all. A man jumping around in Lycra.
Yeah, that sort of movement thing does not work, does it? Just jumping up in the air and that kind of...
And then the fact that John Pertwee is allowed to shake his head around and talk, but he doesn't pick up on that. That's fine. It's, you know, it's I don't know. I get what you're saying, and I think that the Matrix gives you a lot more plot devices and a lot more to go with than the Death Zone nowadays, if you see what I mean. Although I do love the Death Zone.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see that come back. They'd have to remodel the Rastan Warrior Robot, but I think if that was to come back. Yeah.
A bit like the Invisible Enemy. Make it invisible forever. You know what I'm saying?
The Invisible Prawn.
But no, it's a fair point. And I think that's the voice isn't it, of a proper classic Doctor Who fan like we are, trying to live in the new Who world, which we love and enjoy and embrace. And I think particularly Series 9 has given us more reference to classic Who, the new Who is ever before, really, in a positive way. But I still think that Confession Dial was genius, and I still think it was part of the Matrix. And that, again, harks back to the classic series in a very positive way for me.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we had that kind of half-hearted attempt at recreating the Matrix at the end of the Trial of a Time Lord. Season, didn't we? I mean, this is a much more successful return to that type of technology.
Yeah, because I think the Trial of a Time Lord, it wasn't used as a plot device. It was used as just whatever, because we're all having an argument, so let's just put in bits whatever we want and we'll make it the Matrix, because I'll have my bit, you know, like Eric Saywood, I'll have my bit, you know, JNT, and it just was very horribly used. But used properly, and I think that there's a lot more gravitas in the Matrix in future episodes of Doctor Who. They could have a whole season in it. So I don't know if you remember, just to go off kilter a little bit, have you seen Star Trek Enterprise?
Yes, a little bit.
Well, that was 4 seasons. It ran for 4 seasons. First two, really good. Third one, they go off into the Expanse, they call it. And they have a full 23 episodes in this Expanse, a sort of surreal universe, which is the best sort of series of it, or season of it. I think you could have a whole season in The Matrix of Doctor Who. Because it could spun off into whatever it wants to.
Yeah, well, it's like all things really. If there's a good enough story to tell in that environment for that long, then yeah, why not?
Yeah, but bring it to some sort of reality as well, not just go off and have what they did in Trial of the Time Lord, which was horrendous.
Hands coming out of barrels of water.
It was really surreal. Bless Colin Baker, because he could have been. He was a great actor, and he would have been a good Doctor. As we've heard on Big Finish, if it wasn't for, I don't know, a lot of confusion at the time. I don't know what it was, but something.
Well, many factors working. Poor old Colin. Mm. Good. All right. Well, on to the next one. This is an email. This is from Matthew Rose. He's talking about Hellbent. Hellbent was an explosive finale and a great way to end Capaldi's second year. Rachel Talalay is without doubt one of the show's best directors. Her camera angles match the incredible script by Stephen Moffat. Now, this is what I really wanted to talk about. I'd like a Big Finish audio or another TV episode explaining and developing more of the Sliders and the mysterious woman in the barn. Was she the Doctor's mother? A regeneration from Claire Bloom's character from the end of time, perhaps, or a separate entity? I was a little disappointed that Rassilon was defeated so quickly, but this undoubtedly leaves the door open for a return. Clara had a great ending, especially as she now has her own companion and TARDIS. Another Big Finish spin-off, perhaps.
Hmm.
Well, I think there's kind of three points here. Firstly, should we see a return of the sliders that we saw sliding about in the cloisters below Gallifrey?
Well, yeah. I don't see where else you'd put them, really.
Mm.
I don't think they make sense in a lot more context. And they weren't really... they were just there to add a bit of time pressure, you know, as in, you've got to get this done now, because the slides are there, rather than they were a sort of viable monster, really.
Yeah, it's one of the elements that got slightly underused, didn't it, in the midst of all the other stuff that was going on in that episode. And I think we could have done with another five minutes or something about the sliders, but I'm not sure they're worthy of another return, to be honest.
Yeah, because I mean, when I read that, and I thought, who were the sliders? And then, developing, like you're saying, you know, development of the character, I think would be a good idea. But I think it's the cloister room, the idea of the cloisters, it's a new mythology in itself, isn't it, really? Because we've always heard the cloister bell, and we know that's bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a bell in a pub at 10 to 11. Last orders. It's serious.
The worst sound in the world. Yeah.
God, this is the biggest issue we've got right now. So I think if it's a cloister room at the heart of the Citadel, yeah, there'd be a hell of a lot more in that again, just like there would be in the Matrix. So I don't know if you'd have, for example, I'm just going off kilt here a little bit, but you've got the cloister room, which is hell. And you've got the Matrix, which is heaven. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? You've got these two places, which, you know, would be quite surreal. So there's a whole mythology, I think, in them two elements of Gallifrey. But I think Gallifrey itself, there's so much more depth that can be brought from it. And again, going back to what I singled on the Matrix before, didn't I? But I think Gallifrey itself is a season in itself, if you see it. I mean, there's so much more we can do with it. We could do with it, which is why I think I was a bit disappointed with Hellbent, because it didn't put the emphasis on Gallifrey. It was all to do with Clara and the Doctor. So we've got Big Finish stuff going on in here, which is what Matthew's trying to say. There's a lot of spin-off Big Finish stuff, which is what Big Finish does really well, is thinks, right, that little idea that's in Doctor Who, we'll take it and we'll make a series of it, because it's so brilliant and only touched on in Doctor Who. So, you know, what he's saying, I think, is, you know, it could be genuinely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a series, several audio series about Gallifrey, haven't there? I don't know.
I've not listened to any of them, so I don't know what it's like. But there's been a lot of spin-offs within Big Finish. And again, a lot of not really listened to. I'm going to listen to The War Doctor tonight, though. Loaded up, ready to listen to.
Oh, excellent. Well, should be a bit of Gallifrey in there, shouldn't there?
Oh, hell yeah.
But how do you feel about the Clara and a Shilda spin-off?
Terrible. I mean, it'd be terrible. It'd be awful. This was, I think, a big annoyance of mine, was that Clara's now alive, really. I know she's got a point of death or whatever, but the three-parter, if she'd have died and not come back into the third part, it'd been a Gallifrey epic. And I don't know. I don't think it'll work. I don't think it would work. I think it'd be very childlike, and I don't know, there'd be no depth to that plot, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure Big Finish and the writers are so brilliant they would make it, they'd give it depth and whatever, you know, whatever they do, because they do fantastic scripts and fantastic productions, but it's not something I'd be interested in listening to.
No, I don't think I would either. And another podcast, unfortunately I can't remember who at the moment, came up with a very good point about this, and that was, if you've got two essentially immortal characters, you know, there's not going to be a lot of jeopardy in stories that involve those two.
Exactly, yeah.
The other thing is, you know, the availability of the two actresses. I mean, a TV version, you know, is out. I don't think that would ever happen. But I suppose the thing about Big Finish is you can, you know, you can turn up for a day.
2 days,
but a couple of days, just record the thing.
There'd be no wait in it. The only reason why they would do it, I mean, I know they're doing, obviously, The War Doctor. So they've got John Hurt on board and things like that. They've done River Song with the Eighth Doctor, and they're doing Donna and the Tenth Doctor, which is ace because they've got big actors in there. They're going to sell loads more. And I think if they were to do this, they would only be doing it because it's General Louise Coleman and Maisie Williams. I can't see any depth in that at all, can you, as a plot or adventure or whatever.
No, I can't see a lot. And I think the interest, as you say, is going to be a lot lower than it would be on most of the other rates that they have out there.
I'm genuinely excited about listening to The War Doctor, which I've got to listen to late tonight. I've got that on me now. Eighth Doctor River Song, I think that might work quite well.
Mm.
Tenth Doctor and Donna, my favourite, probably New Who Doctor Companion partnership. So it's very exciting. And they've done really well to get, you know, actors of their stature now, you know, from the springboard of Doctor Who to come in for the day, because I think it's just because they're such fans of the show, and Big Finish do such good quality productions that they're on board.
Yeah, quite. Well, I mean, maybe it's something that Moffat could think about once he's off the TV show. He might knock out a few things, just finish that story off, if you like.
Mm.
That might, you know, make it sell a few more units if he's involved. You know, make it much more of an obvious continuation of what he did on the TV show. But, not for me, but, you know, there'll be a small amount of interest, I guess, for those who want all their stories to be finished, kind of thing, because it's left hanging, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
There's another question in this about the woman in the barn.
Mm.
I don't think it's the Doctor's mother. I don't think they looked like they had that relationship. It's something to do with that, whatever that kind of boarding school was that he seemed to be at in Listen, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, I think he escapes to the barn, doesn't he, from school or whatever it is, you know, whatever institution is in there, and she kind of obviously knows that's what he used to do, and knows who he is, you know, quite well. She knows what the implications of what he's done will be for him. So yeah, I think it's someone that's he's been in her care, but you know, I don't think it's the mother.
But I quite like the subtlety of that, though, the fact that we don't know, and we've that happened before. It's just a look of, is that Doctor's mum? You know, it's like, I like that. I like the way they've done that.
Yeah, it was never answered on screen. It's only
answered. It should just be, that's, I think, the beauty of Doctor Who is when you keep him as mysterious and, you know, the voice, it's in his core of mystery. Mm. He can answer, you know, what he needs to, if you see what I mean. And there's always a little surprise. That's the gift that keeps on giving, I think, with Doctor Who.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Well, let's move on to the last one we're going to cover today. So over to you, Bob.
Yeah, it's Jamie Limond. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It's an email again, old-fashioned. Heaven Sent was an astonishing story that somehow managed to be genuinely horrifying, in brackets. The Doctor holds his own skull. And that was pretty terrifying, especially
with the
quantity of it as well, which added to the severity of the situation. And at the same time, it made an eternity of fear, pain, death, and loss. A joyous pair. Oh, God. That's the one. To never giving up and never giving in. But the biggest revelation I've ever sent, get up off your ass. The Doctor thinks in swear words.
So, what do you think of Arsegate?
It did maybe shock me a touch. But I think the last run of Doctor Who, it was a lot more adult, which is why it was going past the watershed of 9 o'clock. And it was in context for me. I thought it worked well where it was, because he needed that kick up the ass.
Yeah.
They could have worded it differently, they could have done whatever, but it didn't stand out particularly for me. I think bloody, when it's been used previously in Doctor Who, or crap, I think crap's been used before. And these are all sort of trivial. They're not really swear words, are they?
They're kind of low-level swear
words. They're the kind of the swear words, you know, when you get to about 12 years old that your mum lets you say. You know, you can't say, I'm not going to say it because Rob.
The F-bomb or the C-bomb.
Yeah, the F-bomb or the C-bomb. But, you know, the bloody, the crap, the arse. Probably not in that order, because it's that sounded wrong. But, you know, it's
sounds pretty medical.
Yeah, they're all right. I think they're not bad things. And it's how you put, I think swearing in general, just to cover swearing, not just in Doctor Who, is done in a context, or it's depending what context it's done. Sometimes the F-bomb, the C-bomb or whatever, it can be put into a sentence or said in a certain way, which I swear a lot, which I don't do on Prog 2 and I'm not doing here. But in general life, I do. And on stage, I do as well. And my feedback to my swearing has been, I do it in a certain flowery way where it doesn't sound like it's so offensive. So the C word, it trips off my tongue, for example. But if you hear a horrendous chav in the street saying it, it's done in a vicious way. Do you see what I mean? It's meant with contempt. So I just think it's how you put a swear word, no matter how you know, where on the scale it is into context, really. And yeah, that was put into good context.
Yeah, affectionate C bombs and F bombs are fine.
Yes, Jim, they are.
But, I mean, the way I stand on this, I mean, there's quite a lot of bloodies have made it to the screen in Stephen Moffat's era. And, you know, obviously I personally couldn't get less, but it does jar a little bit. And I think it's because there isn't really any need for it. I think in a show like this, you can write around that. You don't need it for impact. You can make impact in other ways, I think. And, yeah, I mean, it doesn't bother me particularly. I'm not sure. I mean, I've got a 5-year-old daughter. I'm not sure I'd necessarily want her to hear those words. And, you know, as we know, there are still young people listening to Doctor Who, we hope. So I just, you know, I kind of rather it wasn't there. But on a personal level, it doesn't bother me in the slightest. It just, you know, the young ears are listening is all I would say.
I think this last series, Doctor Who's got a little bit confused because it's been on that border of the watershed to get that bit more adult and darker. And I think they maybe thought they needed to include said words. But it's kind of a fine line because obviously you're saying your daughter's, you know, 5 years old. Mm. You still want to watch Doctor Who because we watched Doctor Who when we were, you know, 3-4 years old, and it was the most magnificently awesome, magical show you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And the Doctor Who, I think that's my thing with Doctor Who now. It's not necessarily the darkness or the cleverness or whatever it is. It's the fact that you can't be 4 or 5 and watch it without your parent thinking, oh, he said ass or bloody or crap. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Yeah. Or having that sort of more gore or more horror. I think Doctor Who always needs to be quintessentially the show that anyone of any age can listen to. And
yes,
and all ages sit down in one room and watch it. And I think to have a throwaway line, one word, which can then say, well, I'm not sure if my daughter can watch this. I think that's, you know, a bit silly, really.
Yeah, it needs to be able to appeal to everybody at different levels and not exclude anybody, you know, up to a point. I mean, kids don't have to understand the total complexities of the plot and stuff. As long as, you know, it's an enjoyable ride, that's enough. But, yeah, they shouldn't have words that are kind of stopping parents from allowing them to watch.
Yeah, and rightly so, I think, as well. Is it crossed the line? Has it crossed the line, Jim? Is it crossing a line into...
A little bit, I would say.
You know, you've got a daughter. Mm. Do you think about sort of thinking, oh, can I let her watch Doctor Who now? Or...
Well, if anything, any word sounds slightly unusual, she looks at me and says, can you say that? So, I say, well, you can't say it, but I can.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's kind of one of those things, just better leave it out. You don't need, it doesn't need to be there, does it?
No.
It's so easy to leave this stuff out, then why don't you just do that?
Yeah. And also it makes it clever, doesn't it, as well, I think. You know, it's not the word, it's the action, isn't it? So she's wanting, you know, Clara's wanting the doctor to literally get up his ass, but it's how, you don't need to say that. It's just the passion, or it's a bit clever wording, really.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Okay, I think that's us done for the time being, Bob. Would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you, other than here?
I live at... the podcast that I do that's Doctor Who related is Progto Who, progtowho.co.uk. And as I said at the beginning of the programme, this is a shameless plug, by the way, but I'll keep it brief. Me and two of my friends, Mark Atkinson and Craig Stimson, we talk about Doctor Who and we play prog rock or music in between us and yattering on. And it's usually all right. So if you want to check it out, and Jim has a bit of input as well with us, and occasionally is kind enough to join us as well. But yeah, if you want to check us out, have a listen. We're on iTunes and that. Prog, as in Prog, Tahu, Prog Tahu, and that's us.
Cool. Yeah, I can thoroughly recommend Prog Tahu, especially when I'm not on it.
No. I'm doing now. Crinoid podcast. I'm going to put it out there. Is my favourite Doctor Who podcast.
Oh, Bo, bless you. Bless you for saying that.
I'm not going to tell you why, because it might sound insulting, but it's not. But it is my favourite.
Good one. Thank you very much for that. And Prog 2 happens to be my favourite, and I'm not even lying. But you can find me at Crinoid Podcast. As I say, crinoidpodcast.wordpress.com is our blog site, and you can look us up on Twitter and Facebook and iTunes and all that stuff. Crinoid, in case you're unfamiliar with Seeds of Doom, if you are, stop listening to this and go and watch Seeds of Doom.
It's my favourite Doctor Who adventure ever, so you better be.
Oh, it is?
It is. Yeah.
Yes, Crinoid is spelled K-R-Y-N-O-I-D, so Crinoid Podcast. So, yeah, but love to have you along. And thanks very much for listening to this. This, we hope, is the first of many.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have you with me here, Bob.
Indeed, Jim. It's been nice. It's been nice. Sort of just, I love, like, particularly on our podcast, I know you do it as well, the listeners' feedback. I love just seeing the difference in the feedback, which is why I think that the letter thing is fascinating. Because there's so much, you know, you've got your opinion, I've got my opinion, and we've got the opinion that's instigated by the person that writes in. I just think it's nice. And more opinions in Doctor Who, the better. Because if everyone loved it, it wouldn't be, you know, doing what it always, you know, it's always done, which is, you know, try and break boundaries and do more brilliant writing and better itself. And that's why it's lasted for so long. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. And thanks to you, Bob. And we hope to have your company next time.
Indeed.
Cheers.
We are the Letter Lords. Goodbye.
Welcome to the first instalment of the Who Teaks Roadshow. With me today is Mark from 42 to Doomsday. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well, Rob. How are you?
I'm very well. How's the new year treating you so far?
Quite relaxing. I'm on holidays at the moment. A little bit of time to myself. I've been watching some movies and TV and playing with the kids. It's been lovely.
So just kicking back nice and relaxed and ready to be our first victim. I mean, first guest.
Yeah, thanks for that.
On the Who Teaks Roadshow.
This is going to be very easy for me. My co-host is called Rob.
Yes.
And you're called Rob.
Yes.
So it feels like I'm doing my own podcast, so let's go.
Well, speaking of your co-host, let's talk briefly about 42 to Doomsday. It's a podcast, which some of our listeners likely know, but for those who don't, tell us all about it.
Started off in 2013 with myself and my co-host Rob. We talk about all things classic and all things new series as well. So we do a variety of topics. We've had topics relating to merchandise. We've had topics such as our top five, which seem to go down well with people. What else can I tell you about it? It's sort of, you know, the Muppet Show had the two guys in the box, Statler and Waldorf. It's sort of, that's us.
It is.
In Doctor Who podcasting land.
It is.
And lots of desk thumping. And lots of other fun segments, we hope, as well. We have a particular segment called Drag from the Archives, which is me going through my old copies of DWB.
I love that.
It goes down well.
I love that. And I think it shows the more things change, the more they stay the same when it comes to fandom.
It's Groundhog Day, isn't it?
It is.
Just change the names and the arguments are still the same.
Exactly. You also have some great guests as well.
Yes, we've had Andrew Smith come on.
Mm-hmm.
We've had Richard Marsden's come on as well.
Great interview, that one. That was about the Verity autobiography.
Yeah, the Verity book, yeah. Went down particularly well as well. We had an interview with a chap called Dave Hoskin, who's writing a book on the Omni rumour. So he'll be back on next year, or this year, I should say. We had a couple other podcasters on.
Mm-hmm.
J.R. Southall. A friend of ours, Rob Lloyd, he's a local comedian in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Doctor Who nut and Star Wars nut as well. He's been on,
so. His ones are very good because he's helped host some official Doctor Who events here in Australia, so he has some real insight into how they go on, and he's spoken about it quite openly on your show, I feel.
Yes, it has. Hopefully not harming his future employment prospects, but yeah. We try and keep it fun and lighthearted.
Yeah, no, it is good fun. Well, look, thank you for joining us today with your Doctor Who boutique, as I'm calling them from today.
Yes.
What have you brought for us for the people at home who can't see it?
When you contacted me and said, would you like to participate? I said, yes. And I said, how many can I talk about? And you said, one. I said, oh, that's really hard. So I had a couple. I was going to talk about my Ultimate Adventure poster, which was signed by John Pertwee. I thought, no, it's too niche.
Yeah.
And then I was going to talk about my Doctor Who Bulletin collection, which I got from issue 4 onwards. And I thought, no, it's probably too niche as well. So I've probably gone for the more sentimental piece of merchandise in my collection, which is a dinky 42A police box die-cast model.
Wow. Now, for those of you at home, these were originally produced, I think, for model train sets. Would that be right?
I think so. Dinky, I believe, was a division of Meccano.
Yes.
So if anybody had a Meccano set... Are they still making Meccano? I don't even know if they're still making Meccano these days.
I've seen it in shops, but I'm not sure if it's Meccano brand or whether it's just that genre of building toy, if that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, it's all been taken over by Lego. It's everywhere.
Mm.
Yeah, but you're right. It came with a It was also found in a box set with a police motorcycle patrolman as well. And it was sold in the 50s. But this, for many years, was the, I suppose, the unofficial toy of the 60s, where you could have your own little police box. But you didn't have any figures to go with it. You couldn't put a figure, and it's very, very small. It's only about 2.5 inches high.
That's right. Now, I found it quite interesting because looking at it, it has some differences, I guess, from the Doctor Who police box. And that's probably in keeping with the fact that in the UK, police boxes did sort of come in different shapes and sizes and configurations.
Yeah, that's right. Still got the police sign, the little lantern on the top, it's highlighted in red. The St. John's plaque is there, so it's sort of now closer to the new series TARDIS than what it was to the original series TARDIS.
Now, if yours is like the ones I've been looking at, where the little sign is on the TARDIS front, where it has the, you know, the officers and cars respond to calls, etc.
Yeah,
there is a plain sort of whitish silverish plaque.
That's right.
And then another plaque on the panel below that to simulate, I think, the plaque with the writing on it. And the circular logo, which I assume is the St. John's Ambulance, is next to that. So
that's
a panel down from where we see it on the Doctor's TARDIS, for example.
Yes.
And I thought, now that's really interesting. What's the story there? And I went digging online for some old police box pictures, came across all the wild and wonderful styles they've had over the years. And I realised that what that's probably simulating there is the first panel is where the phone is. And the next panel down where the sign is separate to where the phone is.
Okay.
So on, like on the Doctor's TARDIS where the sign opens to reveal a phone, on your model there, what would happen is the phone is behind that blank panel rather than the panel with the sign. That's why it's got two panels essentially on that left-hand side.
So it's not an exact replica, but it was the closest you had.
Exactly, it would be. It would be. And looking around online, I do see some of them are sold with those accessories you mentioned, and a lot have parted company with those accessories as well. And when we get to the end of this segment, I'll talk about, you know, some values, and you might have some thoughts on value too with regard with and without accessories. But getting back to your story, when did you first come into contact with this? Obviously, this was made before you were born.
Yeah.
So where did you first come into contact with it?
It was actually my father's. As a child, he used to play with this. And when I used to go to my grandparents when we were living in the UK, I used to play with it. I didn't really associate it much with Doctor Who at the time. And when we moved over here, and of course I became a fan, we used to speak to my grandparents on the phone. And I said, oh, do you still have that TARDIS? So we're going to have a look for it. On one of their visits when they came out, they found it and brought it over for me.
Oh,
I've had it ever since. So it's more sentimental value these days than monetary value. So I can't probably never get rid of it. You know, it's on my bookcase, and you know, when I look at it, I just think about them, really.
And do you know why your father had it? Was he using it in dioramas or train sets, or was he just playing with it as a playset, as I imagine kids probably would have as well when they got these things?
Do you know what? I've never asked him the question. I probably should have rang him actually before I came on and just checked out. Look, I imagine he used to play with it as a child, you know, outside. Or unless he had that Zabi give a movie projector show and maybe did his own. I'm not too sure.
So quite possibly he got it because of the car in the playset and the police box was secondary.
He might have, yeah, which is ironic, really, because he later became a policeman. So it must have rubbed off in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, talking about that, has it rubbed off in you in some way in terms of maybe kickstarting a love of collecting other police boxes or other TARDIS models? Or have you picked up many over the years?
The one I really wanted in the 70s was the Dennis Fisher one that came out. I really wanted that. And a friend of mine, he had one, and with the Gareth Hunt, Tom Baker doll. Do you remember that Dennis Fisher police box? He used to put the Tom Baker doll in and he used to turn the lamp on the top and press a green button and it would disappear.
What would disappear? He would disappear?
Yeah, the actual Tom Baker figure would disappear. Basically like a little internal door. You turn the siren on the top of the police box, press a button and the actual figure would sort of disappear or sort of slide behind another little panel.
Do you know,
in the back.
I have vague memories of it, but I also think there might have been other toys that used that same mechanism to make things disappear,
yeah.
Which is what I'm probably confusing them with in my mind. But I do know the doll you mean, because when I was growing up, I had a friend. He was the president of the local chapter of the Doctor Who fan club in our area, and he had one. And I just had no idea where you would get such a thing. This was like the mid-80s. And in fact, over these Christmas holidays, I've been thinking about buying one, because I've seen a few online, you know, they sometimes are missing the scarf or the hat or whatever, and I found one that was pretty much complete, and I thought, oh, should I or shouldn't I? But it was over $100, and I was sort of, you know, had other things to buy at the time.
Yeah, I remember when they came out in the 70s, I remember asking my parents for one, and instead I got an Evel Knievel bike and figure.
Oh, they're similar.
They're similar. And I think the year after I asked it for it again, and I got the $6 million man figure. So, yeah, Santa didn't provide on those occasions. And like you, I've been looking online for those Dennis Fisher police boxes and to see how much they are. And some of the conditions of them aren't that great. But the mint ones go for a lot of money. Quite surprising, actually.
Well, I was going to say, in my travels, I'm not even sort of coming across those police boxes at all. So I'd say they must be pretty rare.
And the only other model I got police box was the money box. And you open the doors and it has David Tennant and Rose in there saying, "Did you miss me?" After series two, Rose, I certainly did not miss you.
No. No.
No.
That's interesting. When you said money box, I have a ceramic money box, a 60s police box.
Oh, yeah.
Which is ceramic, and that's a money box. Very, very simple, just has a rubber stopper on the bottom, and you can put your coins in, and that's pretty much all it is. Because I've got to say, I got into collecting a lot of different police boxes over the years, and that would be probably the oldest one I have. Do you remember the Peter Davison pencil box one, the little tin?
I do, yes.
Where he's standing in the doorway of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did you see the Easter egg that they did with Davison digressing a bit?
Please do.
The same picture, but it had this inappropriate sort of laser bolt coming out from his groinal region.
No.
Okay, I'll send you the picture.
That sounds bizarre.
Yes, but have you got any of the character options police boxes?
I do, actually, yes. I have one of those, but I also have a Daypole one.
Ah.
Which, for the folks at home, Daypole was a company before Character Options that did a 3.75-inch range of Doctor Who figures.
Yes.
They were famously horrible. They were...
and inaccurate.
Yeah, absolutely horrible. Well, when you say inaccurate, you're probably thinking of the Davros figure.
The Davros figure, with two arms.
Yes.
And the green canine.
Yes.
And the five-sided console.
Yes.
I went to their factory a couple of times, actually.
Did you really? Yeah. How did you come to do that?
Well, because my relatives live about 5 miles from the factory.
Yes.
So when I used to go over, they had a little exhibition there. This is when this is the Wilderness Years, people, when things are bad. And no global road festivals or things like that. It's a little exhibition stuck in the middle of North Wales. And you'd go and have a look around the factory, and then they had a little merchandising shop, which was quite good, actually. I picked up a few bits and pieces there, like Target books to replace some of the ones that got worn. And they had a little exhibition in there. They had Bessie. They had basically all the props from the Blackpool exhibition that closed in the mid-80s.
Oh, okay.
And I've still got the program somewhere. From my last visit, the factory's long gone now.
Right.
But they had Bessie at the front, so I got a picture of that. They had Cybermen in there. I think the TARDIS console was in it. The Five Doctors one was in there as well. And they used to do a lot of Doctor Who events.
Far out. I didn't realise they were so into it. Like, obviously, I knew they made the figures, but I didn't realise they would have had a display like that. That's really interesting, actually.
And even though the exhibition is gone, the little tourist sign for the town where it's in, which is called Llangollen, has a little Dalek still there. Even though the factory's long gone, it still has a little tourist sign with Dalek this way.
Very nice. I remember those days. You know, obviously I say the figures were terrible, and they were, you know, because it was a small sort of cottage industry. They just were not good. But I remember the first time I saw an advertisement for them. I think it was the back page of Doctor Who magazine. I was just amazed. I was dumbfounded. I was probably like 13 or something at the time. And I'd grown up with Star Wars figures and all the great action figures of the 80s to that point. And then I thought, they're making Doctor Who action figures. Oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, even though they weren't the best, they blew my mind. And I bought figures at the time, like I bought a Sylvester and an Ace and the Imperial Dalek, which I still think the cream and gold Daleks are a great color choice. But I never got the TARDIS, and it was probably many years later, probably in the 90s, late 90s sometime, that I found one on eBay. I think I bought it from somewhere like Canada. And that seemed an awfully long way to be bringing something from, but I thought, these must be so rare. Since then, I've realised they're not that rare. They haven't really gone up in value to a huge degree. Certainly not like these other TARDISes that you're mentioning with the disappearing act in them. Mm. So you can still get the Daypole TARDISes pretty cheap, but I'm still glad I've got one. I mean, like the figures, it's not hugely accurate. It's reasonable, but it's fairly basic.
That was the only thing we had back then, wasn't it? I think we were expecting Kenner-like quality of the figures, but it was more like Ken Dodd type quality, wasn't it, really?
Well, you know, in their defence, playing devil's advocate, unlike Star Wars figures at the time, the Daypole figures at least had elbow and knee articulation.
Yes.
So you could bend them into different shapes, have them sit in chairs, I guess, if you had chairs in that scale or whatever. Still not great, but they, in that sense, they were slightly better than Star Wars figures, but in terms of the sculpts, in terms of the paint jobs, they were certainly lacking.
Mm. And I don't think they were distributed in the shops like the Character Options ones were, in terms of you could only get them. I know they got them in Melbourne here in Minotaur Book, the sci-fi specialist shop in town, and they were really pricey for, they used to import them straight through.
Yeah,
this is mid to late 80s, or late 80s, should say. And they were very pricey. I never bought any of them.
Yeah, I would have bought mine probably late 91, and I was in the UK at the time, and I was at somewhere like Forbidden Planet. I certainly never sort of came across them in my travels to specialty bookstores in Sydney at the time. And I was doing that fairly regularly, like every month or so. I just never saw them. Mm. So, they're a fond memory. But you mentioned Character Options, of course, and they make a great TARDIS, and they also made those wonderful original series figures. I never dreamed I would ever see a 6-inch Brigadier or a 6-inch Joe Grant or a 6-inch, you know, take your pick. They've made so many from the original series.
Perry,
yeah, there's a Perry action figure. Like, what? And different versions of Colin Baker, you know, depending on whether you buy him in a box on his own, or a box with a stealth Cyberman, or the collector's box where you got all 11 Doctors at the time in a box. Mm. He had, like, different waistcoats, different cravats, and so on. So many variations. It just blew my mind. And when they moved to just doing 3.75-inch figures, which I think they've realised was a mistake, and they're moving back to doing bigger ones now, I was so disappointed, because it just blows my mind still that 6-inch figures from the original series of Doctor Who exist at all. I thought there'd be no interest or big enough interest to justify them.
I'm looking at the top of my bookcase, and I've got the first Doctor. They did a bundle, like a collector's pack, with a Dalek Invasion of Earth Dalek.
Yes.
And I've got the Troughton Doctor with a Tomb of the Cybermen, a Pertwee Doctor and a Sea Devil, Tom Baker season 18 and a K-9. I've got Davison and Anthony Ainley's Master.
Yes.
McCoy and a Cream Dalek.
Nice.
And I've got single figures for 9, 10 and 11. I haven't got 12 yet. I should get round to 12.
Yeah.
And I've got Colin Baker and a Cream and Gold.
Those Doctor's package with Daleks are awesome. And there's a McGann one, which is quite interesting, because you can get McGann, who looks like the TV McGann, in the box set of Doctors. But the one package with a Dalek is based on his comic appearances in Doctor Who magazine.
Yes,
and
that's
right. And he's got a blue coat and different coloured pants and so on. And the Dalek, I think, is from memory, it's a bright red one or something. It's certainly colourful, and it's from an appearance in Doctor Who magazine. So I love those Doctors and Dalek boxes for the 50th anniversary. I don't actually own any.
Yeah.
Looking around my study at the moment, I'll try not to lose my voice from the microphone. I've got a lot spread all over the place. I kind of like the quirky ones they bring out, like Peter Davison in Tom Baker's clothes from, you know, Legopolis, the end of Legopolis.
Oh, yeah.
That's a fun one, because they even because Peter Davison didn't start streaking his hair, I think, until he took on the role proper, this figure has browner hair than the other Peter Davison action figures.
It's accurate, then.
It is. It's accurate. Yeah. Well, speaking of accurate with the Davison figures, the original Davison figure they put out didn't have celery on his lapel. And I have one of those as well, so, yeah.
How did that get past QA?
I don't know, but the original Peter Davison, just packaged on his own with blonde hair, is missing the celery. And that's for sure, because I have one right here. He got the celery in the end, so if you've got that, as I keep harking back to that gift box with all 11 doctors in it, he has celery in that one.
I've got the war doctor as well, but he sits in the cupboard.
Now, there's an interesting action figure because they packaged it with a Paul McGann head.
Yeah, I just put McGann head on it. That's good enough for me.
The problem being, McGann never wore the costume that the War Doctor is wearing.
But he should have, Rob. He should have.
Well, maybe he should have, but I could never figure that out. It's like, yeah, put the Paul McGann head on. And it's like, yeah, but he never wore this costume.
No, it's, and they bought a figure out with his... well, new-ish costume, didn't they, from the Night of the Doctor?
That's right, and it looks a million bucks. He's got those wonderful long lace-up boots that remind me of sort of like officers' boots from World War One or something like that. They just give me that vibe. Just great. Yeah, I love that costume, and the shorter hair, fantastic.
And it's about $1 million on eBay at the moment.
Is that right?
I've seen some online for about £30.
Jeez. I wonder if JR Southall got one. I know he was looking for one. He was saying, if anyone's out there, you know, please get me one. This was a month or so back.
Help me, anyone. You're my only hope.
Yeah, so I believe they might have even been hard to find in UK stores. So we're completely stuffed out here, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the ABC shops do get a small range of the figures, don't they?
They may do. I don't go into ABC shops all that often. To be honest, but I think they do. I think they've got a range of all sorts of Doctor Who stuff.
I know the Minotaur books in town, they used to get vast quantities of them, of the figures over, but you go past their bargain bins and there's just a whole pile of figures from like Series 2, the Granny from The Wire and Laszlo from Daleks in Manhattan. Just, they haven't moved in 3 or 4 years. They've still got $10. Guys, just put them down to 50 cents. You might shift them more.
Yeah. That brings up something I was saying earlier. Again, Character Options went out of their way to make all these classic era figures as well. But they also just went crazy and were making, as you say, the Granny with no face. I mean, who honestly wants to play with the Granny with no face? You know, even if you're a kid with a lot of imagination, how much can you do with the Granny
with
no face?
It's a bit weird, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's not really appropriate.
It's just
toddler
weird.
Entertainment. Yeah, it's bizarre. Yeah, they went really, really niche.
Yeah, and I sometimes wonder whether that pullback to the smaller figures was because they just had reached out so far and wide, whether they'd maybe slightly overstretched themselves and sort of pulled it back a bit. I don't know.
It's like that Colin Baker figure with the blue costume from Real Time. I mean, that's fan wank.
Well,
and they've had a figure of it.
I know. It's incredible. Getting back, though, to your Dinky TARDIS...
Yes.
I've had a look around online at some values, and I think you have too. We haven't compared notes.
No.
So what if we start trading some figures back and forth?
Okay. Well, I had unrealistic expectations, I'll be honest, when I looked online. I thought, it's got to be worth a couple of hundred quid at least.
Is that were you honestly thinking that?
I was honestly... Look, you know, the Nile is not a river in Egypt. So I thought, I'm quids in. But I looked on eBay, the UK eBay, and the prices seem to range from about 22 quid to about £30. And don't really seem to be going much more than that. So unless you've been able to, you can give me some better news.
Ooh, it really depends on condition, because I was finding that there's two things here, like there is in a lot of collecting stuff like this. One is, how old is it? And a lot of them couldn't really quantify how old they were.
Yeah.
They would say it's vintage or it's rare. One person said it was 60s, because obviously yours is from the 50s, but obviously they were making them in the decades since as well. So you will find better ones, but will they be as old? Well, I don't think the people selling them really know. So with, you know, maybe only one or two pictures and a scant description from these people, it's kind of hard to tell how old they are as well.
Yeah, that's right.
But in general, I'm finding something a bit beat up is about $40 Australian.
And mine's pretty beat up, to be perfectly honest.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I found better condition probably around 60.
Mm.
I found one with the plastic policeman, but not with a car, and it was in good condition too. It was around 60.
Mm.
And then I found one in really good condition, but it didn't have the car or the policeman, and it was, say, $70 Australian.
So what you're telling me, I should keep working.
I think so. But as they say on Antiques Roadshow, it's a nice thing, and you probably wouldn't part with it. And
I won't, no.
It's probably pride of place somewhere in your collection.
It is. It's on the bookcase. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. Okay, well, it seems we're on the money there with the money.
Yeah, thanks for disappointing me.
Hey, it's what we're here for.
Thank you.
But you've actually inspired me. I've got to say before we go, you've inspired me to maybe look one of these up, because I do have, as I say, lots of different TARDISes. I even have, talking of model train sets, an HO scale TARDIS, which is fairly small. It's probably about half an inch, maybe a bit bigger than half an inch high. And it's incredibly detailed. It's a modern sort of thing. So with modern production processes, they can, you know, paint them quite well, even when they're tiny. So I have, starting from that little one right up to a TARDIS ice bucket, which is fairly largish. So I've got all sorts, but I don't have one of these. And knowing that they came with the policeman and the car, I think I might try and hunt one down. I didn't see one on my travels to get these prices, but I'm sure there are some out there. I think it might be a fun thing to have in my collection.
And I'm going to have a look at a character options TARDIS as well.
Yes, why not?
Because I don't think the Dennis Fisher one I can afford. Unless we start up our own Patreon accounts, Rob.
Oh, look, we could. You know, if anyone... No. No, I'm not going to go down that route. yeah, and I think with the character options TARDIS, I'm just looking around at mine. You might find them for different doctors, like when you open the doors, have different scenes inside them.
Okay.
Different console rooms and so on. And, of course, then that leads to console play sets and all kinds of other things. And, oh, the Lego console room is out now. There's all sorts of stuff you can buy.
I got that for my birthday.
Did you really?
Yes.
Is it nice?
Yes. I haven't started building it yet. Yes, it's very nice. Although I have been playing Lego Dimensions on the Xbox, and that's been quite a bit of fun.
It looks like fun. I don't have a console, though, to play it on. I'm a PC gamer, so...
No, it's good fun, actually, and my son is really getting into it.
Excellent.
Which is great to see, yeah.
Excellent. Well, look, thank you for joining us today, Mark.
No, thank you, Rob, for having me on your inaugural show.
My pleasure, and I hope people out there have enjoyed hearing about your dinky TARDIS and all the other things we spoke about, and maybe they'll be adding things to their collections over the months ahead too.
I hope so as well.
One more thing. Where can people find 42 to Doomsday? We spoke about it at the start of the show, but where can they actually find your episodes and hear all this great stuff you've been making?
Oh, thank you. We're on the iTunes,
yes.
Stitcher.com,
mm-hmm.
Player FM, also on Facebook, 42 to Doomsday, on Twitter, at 42 to Doomsday. Our blog is 42todoomsday.wordpress.com.
Excellent. So you've got it all covered there, I think.
I hope so.
All right. See you later.
Thanks, buddy. Cheers.
Welcome to the TARDIS Library. A place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
Hello, this is Mark Souter, reviewing Doctor Who, The Tenth Doctor, issue 2.4. It's back to the deep, deep past and the dawn of humanity for the Doctor and Gabby, as their travels take them to the Pleistocene era, and the epic struggle between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon forces for the future of humankind. Now, this was a very interesting story. It started out a little weak, but got stronger as it went on. As with any era that the Doctor visits, there's always an alien or future influence. And it's pretty clear from the start that our Neanderthal narrator has seen some kind of extraterrestrial activity. He's trying to convince his fellow tribesmen to help the other tribes, because they're disappearing off the face of the earth. There's urgency to the story. The plot moves along quickly. The introduction of the Doctor is very interesting, as is the companion Gabby. One thing that I will say that annoys me in comics is when the narrator is supposedly less than human or different from being human, and their thought balloon and the font within the thought balloon is different, which can sometimes make it hard to read. It's trying to convey the idea that they think differently or speak differently than us, but it just comes across as clunky, especially when you have a character like the Neanderthal in this that is eloquent and well-spoken and has an almost poetic way of thinking. It doesn't really ring true for the character. So there's some points there. Also, the art is just okay. It's not hyper-detailed. It gives the spirit of the characters, but not really a strict interpretation of what they actually look like. In some panels this works, in some it doesn't. There is some issue where the lighting source seems to change depending on what character you're looking at within a panel or from panel to panel. But overall, that only knocks it down a couple of points because the story itself is pretty good. When you're introduced to the doctor, he's actually unconscious and Gabby is trying to speak to the Neanderthal. And what's interesting is that some of the words that Gabby says don't make sense to the caveman simply because he doesn't have the equivalent words in his language, probably. And this happens throughout the issue, as it seems that the TARDIS translation matrix isn't quite conveying everything between the two characters. So as you go, it gets better as they understand each other more. And the issue ends on a good cliffhanger with the doctor and Gabby and the caveman separated and in peril between the two warring races of ancient aliens, as it were. Overall, the issue captures the voice of the 10th Doctor, of David Tennant, very well. So while I would probably give the issue a 3 or maybe 3.5 stars out of 5, it's not because the story is lacking. I would give the story itself a 4.5, probably, maybe a 5, because it does capture the elements of what makes a good Doctor Who story. And it is a cliffhanger, so we'll have to see how that resolves. The reason that I would knock it down a point or two is the art just isn't there. As I said, it seems like there's some coloring variations from panel to panel. Also, what I didn't mention earlier is that there's too much contrast between the light areas and dark areas of shadow. So you just kind of get these extreme contrast differences on faces. But the story was fun. It was engaging. And also, as sort of the bonus last page, there was a comedic story about Rose the Cat, which I highly recommend. And also, I should mention that for those who were male subscribers, there was a photo variant of the cover, and it's a really bad Photoshop job. So if you are a subscriber, I'm sorry that you're going to get that one. But otherwise, the one that you can just pick up on newsstands is perfectly good. And I definitely recommend this issue. Once again, this has been a review of Doctor Who, the 10th Doctor, number 2.4. If you're interested in hearing more from me, I'm on 2 Star Wars podcasts. I'm on a bi-weekly podcast called The Idiot's Array and a monthly book review podcast called Tarkin's Top Shelf. You can follow me on Twitter at Mark E. Suter. That's at MarkSutter.
Hello, I'm back. I'm also named Lex. I should have said that first. I am going to be doing the 11th Doctor comic review for the Doctor Who show. How about I give you some opinions on things? To start off, I wasn't crazy about some of the issues that came out after I ended my last review on Who Wars. There were a couple issues that I thought were awful, actually, really bad. So it was probably good that I wasn't doing a review back then because they would have been really harsh. It's just that in this one particular issue, the Doctor was doing some things that I thought he would never do, like walk away from his companions, 3 of them, with no explanation, and leave them completely to themselves for 3 days, wandering the TARDIS, having no idea where he went, just because he had to think. He needed some personal time. I thought it was absurd. But you know, it's just an opinion, and that happens sometimes. I can't love all of them, and luckily I can say that this comic series does have a way of, when I hate something, it really surprises me soon afterwards with something that I absolutely love and adore. So, on to this issue, which I happened to rather love and adore. I've really liked the storyline. It's got great suspense. I'm looking at it now, and first things first, I really like the cover. It's just this bold graphic. It says nowhere left to run, and there's this, the doctor. It doesn't look like him at all. I personally enjoy it because it looks like my ex-boyfriend. None of you know what he looks like, but he really does. So I guess that's a bit of criticism. He doesn't look like the doctor, but I still enjoy it. Look, it's my ex-boyfriend on the cover of the 11th Doctor comic, guys. Moving on. So yeah, it's a really simplistic, minimalistic, artsy cover with maybe not so much detail, but I like the boldness of it. And we start off with this lovely introduction to, is it Gallifrey? It's some planet that's very timey-wimey, and we've got some biological insight into this alien planet with these two bugs that are mating. They have vortex frames, and it's great to look at. Not the bugs doing it. The planet. They've got all these, like, these strange fungus that are red and look like they're about to burst, and huge flowers. Maybe they're trees, but they look like they're flowers, really big ones. Yeah, I loved it. Cool introduction. And of course, it conveniently, this one place explains four questions that have been looming on in the background of the doctor's mind. So lots of, it's a very busy comic. Lots of things going on, really fast pace. Yeah, so it's like great to look at, and it really keeps your mind busy. Yeah, and there's some Centaurans in here with beards. Fruity beards is the precise term used. Trust me on this, you want to see these Centaurans with their beards, if you're a Doctor Who fan at all. They are excellent. And yeah, so they go back to the Time War. This vortex humanoid is still chasing after him. And the Doctor realizes he needs to find the TARDIS of the Master. Basically, as usual for these comics, there's a lot going on, a lot of storylines at once. It's a little bit hard because it's my first review after a long time to summarize everything and give you all the details and give examples. So maybe not the most thorough review, but I am looking forward to the future and next podcast. I can keep you updated, give you some of the mind-blowing explanations for everything that has been going on. I will tell you all about the endings of the spectacular situations they have procured into time and space, or two-dimensional paper, or digital pixels, whichever you prefer to think about. So thanks for listening to this first episode. Take care, everybody, and talk to you next time. Bye-bye!
Hi, I'm Kevin, and welcome to my little corner of the Doctor Who Show. Over the coming months, I'm going to be looking at the 12th Doctor comic books from Titan Publishing, but I'll also be taking a gander at the 8th Doctor and 4th Doctor miniseries, and seeing what they have to offer as well. Hopefully I can string together a coherent sentence or two, and it'll give you some feel for, you know, the kind of comics that are being published out there, and whether you fancy taking a look for them yourself. Firstly, I thought I'd say a little bit about myself. I've been a Doctor Who fan for many, many years, since a young age. Apart from that period in the mid-90s, which I really would rather not talk about, when I kind of let my fandom slip. I really got back into things in around 2004, in the lead-up to the new series. And since then, you know, things have just grown exponentially, and I've appeared on a couple of podcasts and written for a book and written some reviews, and it's all been really good fun. I also write a blog which is called Ravings from the Rubber Room. The tagline for that is SF Fantasy Comics and Other Forms of Lunacy, but really it's a forum for me to write about anything I really fancy, You know, it could be anything from a really unusual TV series to an unheard of comic book or just reviews of the current Doctor Who series. If that, you know, floats your boat and sounds like something you'd be interested in, it's at www.rubber-room.blogspot.co.uk, and I'd be really pleased if you could take a look. Anyway, that's enough about me. Oh, apart from to say, I had stopped reading Doctor Who magazine in around 1986, so although I've been aware that there have been other comic strips published, I've not actually read any of them. I know that IDW had the license for many years, for example. I know that there are Panini collections of the Doctor Who magazine strips that are out there, but I've not read any of them. So when Rob asked me to be part of the Doctor Who show and to start reviewing the 12th Doctor comics, I thought it was a good opportunity for me to get back into things and see, you know, exactly what are licensed comics of my favourite TV show like nowadays. Are they any good? Originally, I was going to go back and read the whole of the 12th Doctor series that has been published to date, which is about 15 issues. But then I thought, well, if I was a new fan coming to the comics, I'd be picking up the latest issue from the comic shop. I wouldn't necessarily be going back and buying all the issues from number one straight away. I might do that later if I really liked the comic. So I decided I was going to start with issue 12, which was the first part of a new four-part story. And that story is called The Hyperion Empire. It's written by Robbie Morrison, who is most well-known to me, at least, for the 2000 AD series Nicolai Dante, which he wrote for over 15 years, I think, plus many other 2000 AD and Judge Dredd strips. There's also two issues by George Mann, who's written some Big Finish audios and the War Doctor novel Engines of War. But Robbie Morrison seems to be the main writer of this particular series. The artist for three of the four parts of the Hyperion Empire is a guy called Daniel Indro, who I've not heard of before, so I had to look him up. He's apparently an Indonesian artist, and has worked on some stuff for Dynamite Comics, such as Sherlock Holmes Year One. Oh, and a four-part Weeping Angel story for the 10th Doctor Titan comic, which I haven't read, obviously. The artist for one of the other parts is a Brazilian artist called Ronelson Freer. Again, he seems to have worked for Dynamite Comics, but he's pretty much an unknown if you've only really been reading, you know, comics from the main publishers. The story starts out with an alien spacecraft which crashes into and destroys the International Space Station, and then crash lands in Lake Windermere. Unit soldiers are sent to investigate, are destroyed, and the only communication is two words: Hyperios rises. We then switch to the Doctor and Clara landing in a deserted and apparently decimated London, full of smouldering zombie creatures. Now, I have to say that I think that Daniel Indro draws very good scenes of destruction. There's some quite lovely pages of London with, you know, the buildings destroyed and rubble everywhere and deserted streets. It's very much in the modern Marvel or DC style, but it is very well drawn, and, you know, the drawings do have backgrounds which you don't get in a lot of modern comics. As for the likenesses of the Doctor and Clara, the Doctor's pretty good. I mean, I'm not one of these people that thinks that, you know, comic book artists have to draw an exact likeness of the character. I mean, even if you look back to the days of Dave Gibbons in Doctor Who Weekly, you know some of his depictions of the Fourth Doctor, particularly at the start, were a little bit off. And certainly when they got to Peter Davison, you know, he struggled quite a lot to get an accurate likeness. But no, Daniel Indro's drawings of the 12th Doctor, Peter Capaldi's, are pretty good. His illustrations of Clara, perhaps less so. She looks a little bit too much like, you know, a generic brunette. But you know it's her, and you know, the art is not the only thing that's carrying the dialogue, captions carry off pretty well as well. We get to the end of the first issue with the Doctor being threatened by these zombies screaming burn, 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 which is quite an effective cliffhanger. The odd thing is, when we jump to the next issue, right there on the front recap page of issue 13 is a sentence that reads, It can only mean one thing. The Hyperions, massive sentient suns, have escaped their stellar prisons and set their baleful gaze on Earth. And I had to look for a minute and think, have I missed an issue? They've actually revealed who the villains are on the front page before doing it in the comic itself. So actually, when I did some research and looked back at the earlier issues of the 12th Doctor series, it turns out that the Hyperion had actually appeared in the first four-parter in issues 1 to 4. So what Robbie Morrison is doing is the general, you know, kind of season arc type thing that the television series does, and bringing back his first villain for a repeat performance at the end of the season. And that's fine, you know, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, don't get me wrong, you do get an explanation for who the Hyperion are in what are quite a lovely pair of splash pages in the issue. But, you know, if you were a new reader, you've suddenly spoilt your big reveal before you even get to show it. I mean, it's just an odd decision, really. Anyway, so it turns out that the Hyperions are these giant malevolent suns that are out to conquer the universe, and they're enslaving the population of Earth to, you know, basically, you know, turn our sun into energy for their plans. And in the meantime, you know, a lot of humans have been transformed into what's called the Scorch, these smouldering ash zombies, with the rest of the population hiding underground. It's worth also mentioning that this series of comics is set before the ninth series, which means you get the more abrasive, more abrupt Doctor, the one that really doesn't care about offending people, the one that needs Clara as his carer. It actually leads to some quite nice sequences with the Doctor being extremely rude to people, you know, calling people pudding brains and the like. It all leads up to a climactic battle between the Doctor and his friends storming the alien spacecraft. And it's the kind of thing you really can only do in a comic book. You could never do this on a TV show budget. You know, it's got a completely devastated London, hordes of zombies, fiery demons and angel creatures. There's even a gigantic web surrounding our sun. And a little bit of time travel thrown in at the end to, you know, defeat the aliens. All in all, I think it was extremely well done. Robbie Morrison's a seasoned comics writer, but as good as he is, you know, it's very difficult to get the feel of a television show right on the page. But I do think he's managed it very well. The characterisation of the Doctor and Clara is spot on. You can imagine Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman reading these lines. Art-wise, I think Daniel Indrow and Ronaldson Freer are excellent, barring one or two odd facial expressions. Their art's very dynamic. The compositions of the panels on the pages are very interesting. Given that there's only so much you can do with the description of fiery demon or, you know, woman covered in flames or zombie, their creature designs are, you know, very interesting and jump off the page. I do think this is helped by the colourist on all four issues, and I apologise for the pronunciation here. It's somebody called Slamet Mugiono. The colours are beautiful and enhance the art enormously. I don't think it would look anywhere near as good in black and white, and it just shows how important the colourist has become to modern day comics. One final thing to talk about, and that's the covers. And here things are not quite so good. I mean, yeah, you know, the drawings or paintings are very good themselves. There's some photo covers, there's some humorous cartoony-like covers, but none of them actually bear any relevance to the story within the pages. I get that what they're going for with this is an image that will attract a reader when they see it on the shelf, rather than a panel from the story. But it's a trend that seems to be a bit too prevalent in comics at the moment. And I do kind of hunger for the days when you used to get a representative panel from the strip that you were going to read inside to give you an idea of at least what the art would look like. Because none of these covers appear to have been drawn by the artist that's drawn the strip itself. Anyway, that's the Hyperion Empire issues 12 to 15 of the Titan 12th Doctor comic. There is one more issue which is described as a holiday special, written by George Mann, and maybe we'll look at that next time. After this, the 12th Doctor comic reverts back to a new number one, and like the 10th Doctor and 11th Doctor comic, starts out with a year two headline. I believe that this is going to be set during series 9, the most recent series that we've watched on television, so it'll be interesting to see how Robbie Morrison, if he continues as the writer, incorporates the changes to the Doctor and Clara's character in the comics that are to come. When those are published, I'll be looking at them probably one or two issues at a time rather than as a four issue storyline. So we'll look forward to that, and I'll see you next month. Bye.
Well, here we are at the end of the first episode of the Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. My thanks to Ian, Jim, Bob, Mark, Lex, and Kevin for their submissions this month. I know all of them are already thinking about what they're going to do next time to really start building a library of work within the show, whether in the form of the A to Z or chatting about fandom based on the letters to Doctor Who magazine, the comic reviews, or whatever it might be. For me, I want to use the ends of these episodes to touch briefly on a topic of interest, whether something in the news or just passing randomly through my grey matter or whatever it might be. And I think the biggest Doctor Who news this month has been the announcement of Chris Chibnall as Stephen Moffat's replacement, but that's not really what I want to talk about. I'm more interested in the elephant in the room, which at this time is whether Peter Capaldi will stay on beyond Series 10. You know, some people say he will. He loves the show. He loves being the Doctor, they say, and that's really true. He does. This is the man who tried to take over the Doctor Who fan club when he was a kid. Doctor Who is in his veins. He not only knows what makes up the character, he knows what it's like to be a fan, but I digress. My thoughts are that when he was announced as the Doctor, he was already 55 years of age. By the time Series 10 goes out, he'll be 59. His birthday's in April, by the way, and I'm taking a punt that we'll have Series 10 around April of 2017. And, you know, at that time, he'll have been the Doctor for 4 years, albeit with only 3 series under his belt. So the question I ask myself is, will a man on the edge of 60, with more projects and ideas in his head than he probably has time for over the next 15 years if he works fairly steadily until he's 75 or so, will he stay on in the role for another year just for the sake of staying on? Or will he look back and think, oh, I've done 3 series, I've been the Doctor for 4 years, you know, it's time for something new. And will he also see the man who hired him, Stephen Moffat, walking out the door and decide to cut himself loose too to go at the same time? Personally, I think that makes sense for Peter Capaldi, and I think that's what will happen. I know a lot of you out there think he will go as well. Even though you love his portrayal and would love to see him stay, I'd like to see him stay too. And, you know, beyond that, I know some of you would just like to see some Doctors staying in the role a little longer than 3 series or 4 years, you know, in the role. We seem to be in a bit of a pattern now, and I know some people would like to see that broken. I know some people love to see a Doctor come in and do like 5 series or something like that, but I don't think that Doctor is going to be the Capaldi Doctor. You know, I also think it'll be good for the series. Chris Chibnall will have a fresh palette to do exactly what he wants. And so long as we hold on to this concept of a single showrunner having all the control, you know, whether you agree with that or not, while ever we have that in place, it's precisely what's needed. The showrunner probably does need to have a fresh palette to really stamp his mark on the show. And I'll be fascinated to see what Chibnall does. I know he's already copped a lot of flack. A lot of people point to the Cyberwoman episode of Torchwood and how cheesy and such that was. But, you know, give the guy a go. Let's see what he comes up with first. I think he's got some real smarts. Now, when will this Capaldi departure, now that I've decided it's happening, when will it be announced? I have no idea. Capaldi's currently dodging the question whenever he's interviewed at present, and I know the BBC won't want to announce his departure too early. They probably want to put a bit of space between the Moffat announcement and the Capaldi announcement so people don't think they're linked in some way. I mean, we'll still think that anyway, but you know what PR people can be like. Regardless of all that, however, is the fact that by the middle of this year, will be a year off Series 11 beginning filming, presumably with a new Doctor and companion. And that's another hot topic at present. Will Capaldi's final series be companionless, or will he have sort of a companion of the week kind of setup? Who knows? But I think a lot of people think that Chibnall will start with a new Doctor and companion. And, you know, the casting for these two parts will have to be announced at some stage. And there you have it. Doctor Who is renewing itself again. It doesn't seem that long ago that I was sitting in my lounge room. It was about 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. or some ungodly time like that to see the Capaldi announcement come through live. And here we are, two series under his belt, a whole year off between Doctor Who Christmas specials, and then a new series in a far-off land called 2017. We're only a month into 2016. Crikey. All right. That's me done. If you like this podcast, do share us around on your social media channels or tell your real-life mates. We'd love to reach as many sets of ears as we can. And if you have anything you want to tell us, either use those social media channels to reach us or email hello@thedwshow.net. That's hello@thedwshow.net. And let us have it, good, bad, or otherwise. See you next month for episode 2 of The Doctor Who Show. You've been listening to The Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. Subscribe to us on iTunes or listen through the website at www.thedwshow.net. Write to us at hello@thedwshow.net or send us a quickie on Twitter @thedwshow. Facebook.com/thedwshow is also a good place to find us if you're so inclined. Our version of the Doctor Who theme arranged by George Locke. Look him up on YouTube, folks. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. Doctor Who, all names and sounds, and any other related items are trademarks and or copyrights of the BBC. All other trademarks and trade names are properties of their respective owners. The official Doctor Who website can be found at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who. Thank you.